Good afternoon and welcome to the final session of Venerable Rubina's teaching on how to enjoy death. She'll be joining us in just a minute. Just a reminder, if you are used to our usual habit at Geshe-la's request, is that we prostrate along with him when he enters the room. That's separate from tradition, so we will wait today until Venerable Rubina is seated to prostrate. If you've never done this, you're uncomfortable with it, that's okay. You can just take your seat. At the end of the teachings, if you wish, you can offer a kata to Venerable Rubina. We have katas here if you don't have one. They're also available in the bookstore for just a few dollars if you wanted to buy one. And at the very end of the teachings, we'll just be coming up and making that offering to her. Check your cell phones. And I think that's all the major things I needed to let you know about. So enjoy yourself, and she'll be with us in just a moment. The other thing is she often opens the floor to questions, and if she does, please wait until you have a microphone because the teachings are being streamed, and you need to hold the microphone up close to your mouth in order to be heard. And finally, Venerable Rubina will be leading a couple of spiritual travel in Asia this year. One is a 5-day retreat at Borobudur in Indonesia. It's a 9th century Buddhist temple. Karen has been there and enjoyed it so much she's pondering going again. Also in October and November, she'll be leading a four-week retreat in India and Nepal. This is both a teaching retreat and traveling to really amazing Buddhist holy sites, the site where Shakyamuni Buddha was born, where he passed, where he and his disciples spent the rainy season in retreat, Rajgir, where he gave the teaching on emptiness, and Bodh Gaya, where he was enlightened. It is a life-changing experience. There are postcards about this on a little table across from the bookstore, and you can also just sign up and leave your email, and they will contact you with more information if you're interested. Thank you.
So we think we're going to, if we were here today, we think we're going to continue to listen to this advice about how to deal with death and dying, one's own and others, according to these instructions from Lama Zopa Rinpoche, taking, of course, from all the instructions from his gurus, etc., etc., in our lineage of Lama Tsongkhapa's teachings in Tibetan Buddhism, coming back from Lord Buddha. To help us live our lives better, be ready for death so we can be prepared for the next life, a decent next life, so we can carry on with our spiritual practice, basically, with as little hindrance, as little interference as possible. And then, of course, on the basis of our becoming clear, we can then help others, which is the most precious thing we can give a person, as Lama Zopa says. And with all the long term in mind of achieving our own marvelous potential for Buddhahood, so we can be of benefit to other sentient beings perfectly. Long term goal. Okay. Sangye charang soke chok nam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chen yen gi pe sonam ki dro la penche sangye dro pa shok sangye charang soke chok nam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chen yen gi pe sonam ki dro la penche sangye dro pa shok sangye charang soke chok nam la Jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi Dagi chen yen gi pe sonam ki Dro la penche sangye drupa shog. So the key points that we went up yesterday, the key points, you know, from the Buddhist perspective, is that given that our consciousness is a beginningless and endless continuity of mental moments, that every millisecond of what we think and do and say programs that consciousness or sows seeds in that consciousness that will necessarily,
This is a natural law. Necessarily ripen in the future after we die as one, our type of rebirth, two, our tendencies, three, our experiences at the hands of others, and four, our environmental results, which means our entire life. The causes of who we are and what happens to us are done by us. This is the key thing in Buddhism. So given this view, and you're trying to live according to the Buddhist view, then obviously the reason to prepare for death, the reason to prepare for death is so you get a decent human life. This is the point. This is the point, you know. So that might not be so strong for all of us. Maybe we're not that used to thinking about karma and future rebirths. Maybe we're not quite convinced yet. Maybe we don't even think of it that often because we're so caught up in the bubble of this life, aren't we? But if we are Buddhists and we try to think about why death is important, this forces us to go to that next point. Because if you have your materialist view, we know perfectly well the reason to think about death is for everybody's sake, including your loved ones, because you want it all to be nice for everybody. But when it's not for the sake of the dying person, because when they're dead, they're finished. Now it's all about us. So it's a very different emphasis here, you know. As I mentioned to you, one person who saw the manuscript said, "Well, where's the chapter about grief? Because that's a crucial point in our culture, because that's what we're left with." And so the main thing in the West is getting people to come to terms with death, not be afraid of death, which is fantastic. And that's included, obviously, in the Buddhist one. But the long-term one is the absolute point for the Buddhist view, you know. And indeed, it will be the same about Christianity. The reason you want to die well is so you can go to heaven with God. It's very straightforward. Very simple. Then we got down to, we discussed yesterday, we ought to ask the question, well, given that the karmic seeds that I leave in my mind by my actions are what determine my next life, the obvious question has to be, well, when does that all happen? It's a really vital point. When does that actually occur? Is it weeks before I die? Is it when I stop breathing? Is it when my mind leaves the body? We've got to be super clear about that. Super clear. And this is the point. As Rinpoche says, helping your loved one, you know, the reference point in this book is helping your loved ones, you know. You can help your enemies too if you like. It's up to you. But we're talking about helping your loved ones. Helping them, Rinpoche says, if you're going to help your loved one in this life, the time to help them is when they die. To help them die. Why? He says it's the most important time. Why? Because that is when the karmic seeds that will determine the next life are triggered. So it's a technical point. It's a really important technical point. Whereas we tend to think of this stuff as kind of vague and religious and all this, you know, but it's quite precise. When we understand that, then we can really begin to educate ourselves how to be of most benefit to your loved one, including a baby, including your senile grandma, including your pussycat. Same logic applies to all of it. Then we can kind of calm down and we can then learn to know, okay, what should I do when? What are the things to do? And that's what this book is. It's like a manual, step by step, what to do when, you know. And like I said yesterday, and we're doing more of this today, I mean, yesterday we went through the general way to live your life, learning to abide by the laws of karma, understanding impermanence, living in our vows, purifying our minds, which we discussed earlier in the day, earlier in the week. This is the way to prepare for your own death. And then there's the actual practical matters of what happens at death. We did that yesterday, the 12 links, how craving is triggered, how that is what triggers the karmic seed. And then the 8 stages of death, what goes on when you stop breathing, what happens here, what happens there. Now we're looking more at the practices, what to do the weeks and months before, what to do the hours before, what to do at the time the breath stops, what to do the hours after, what to do the days after, what to do the weeks after. All of them. Absolutely the central point for every single one of these instructions is how to help your loved one. Every single step of the way. Every step of the way. It's all about how to... It's the dying one's gig, you know? Every decision you make is for their sake. It's for their sake. It's for their sake. If you're going to have to deal with your own family and their stuff, keep it out of the death room. That's your business, separately. Everything in this book is about how to help your person die... come to terms with their death, how to help nourish virtuous karma, how to help them be virtuous peaceful, how to help them when the time they stop breathing, to the period after it, all the way through up to the 7 weeks later, you know, and even after that as well. There's so many things you can do even now. Like, for example, if you've got ashes of your loved one from 20 years ago sitting on your mantelpiece, there's still things you can do, fantastic things you can do with those ashes to help bless them, to turn them into some holy object, and help your own loved one 20 years ago, wherever they might be now. You know, so many practices we can do. And then, of course, as I said, you know, in this book, there are many practices at the back of the book, and it's like two-thirds of the book is the practices. Many of the sutras, there's a Poa practice in there, there's many of the sutras, many long practices, long things to do, all of which are included in Rinpoche's instructions. But you might just choose to do one of those practices. You might just like to do Medicine Buddha. That's perfectly fine, you know. You're the boss in what you choose. So all the practices are laid out. But you can choose all or any. There's so many you could do if you wanted, you know. That's sweet. This is the framework. So let's just keep looking at the different stages, what to do when. And as we were doing yesterday, the different kinds of practices that we can do at different points, you know. Did anybody have any questions in particular from yesterday? Yes. Microphone, please.
I have a very practical question.
A little bit closer to the mic. I think it works better.
A very practical question.
Yes,
closer to the mic.
Closer?
Better. That's fantastic.
Oh, okay. Wow. I had not counted on being kept 3 days in the house.
Yes.
And my husband also did not count on this, and we're wondering,
yes,
about what about the very practical decomposition that occurs. How do you handle that?
Exactly, I understand. So as we're going to go into these, the point about the 3 days is that it's been the experience over the centuries of these great meditators and these lamas that it can take 3 days for the consciousness to leave the body. So, and we're going to get to all this, there are very clear practical ways to check if the consciousness is still there. So as long as the consciousness is there, you will not decompose. So the whole key is to check if the consciousness is there. And there's a very simple way to do it. And we're going to discuss this. So if the consciousness is there, then you won't decompose. But if you, let's say, after you die or your husband die, and the other one of you, you're doing all the prayers and things, and then you check, and there's this easy way to check, and the consciousness is gone, you don't need to leave it for 3 days. Very simple. So there's a way to check that the consciousness is there. It's almost foolproof, you know? And we'll get there in a second.
I had one other thing ask you about.
Yes.
I was thinking about it. I was a hospice nurse for many years.
Yes, amazing.
Yeah, at home.
Yes.
At people's homes.
Yes.
And I always prided myself on keeping people comfortable.
Yes.
With lots of PRNs,
yes.
Ativan, morphine, under the tongue, and that
I missed that last little piece you said. You always prided yourself on...
I always thought I was doing a wonderful job,
yes,
keeping people free of pain,
yes,
and now I'm wondering if I was actually making it so everybody else in the room would be comfortable, including myself.
No, sweetheart, I really understand your point, and that's a very courageous thing to say. There's no doubt, I think, that if you look into your own mind and your own training, that is very much the attitude. And the very strong understanding of what the mind is in the West, we all have this view, don't we, that if the body looks quiet, the person must be peaceful. So I think we can easily disprove that ourselves. When we see we can be lying there quietly, and you wake up in the morning and you tell your husband you had this nightmare dream, and he wouldn't know, you're sitting there quietly. You look peaceful, but you know you're having nightmares. But when we understand this view, as you've been hearing, once the breath stops, or no, even once you, you know, if you're in a coma, that's your subtle consciousness, and it's like exactly the same as being in a dream state, and that could be really scary, that dream state, that coma. So it doesn't follow, yes, that keeping the person quiet, the body peaceful, means their mind is peaceful. But that's okay, sweetheart. You can't take responsibility for that now. We all, you know, when we learn new things, we look differently at things, you know. And that certainly could be, well, also doesn't mean you're, you know, making it bad. Of course it is for the sake of the people, but this isn't the issue here we've got. And this is why Rinpoche and the lamas are so clear. And really, if you're in charge, say, of helping a person die, you really have to know the people you want on your team, and that they have to be educated, even if they're not Buddhist, but they might be happy to be educated in the Buddhist approach. Let's say if the person is dying as Buddhist, and they will honor that person's wishes. So they've got to recognize that this is the way we're describing it. You don't have this. You don't have all people, their emotions. You don't have the pets there. You don't have all loud noises. All of these things. And you explain the Buddhist approach to it. So the people who are in that room, and the person who's dying should want those people in that room. They should be people they trust and love. So it sort of all makes sense, really, you know? Do you understand?
Thank you.
Do you understand?
Thank you.
But darling, you can rejoice in what you did. It was a marvelous job you did, so don't doubt it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Just about throwing karma?
Yes.
So is this the piece you were talking about, that the lamas, that you were getting information different? Was it about throwing karma that was confusing? So I'll just say what I'm thinking, and you tell me if it's right or wrong. So we have moments of grasping all the time.
We have what?
Moments of grasping.
Okay.
Our
okay.
whole life.
Putting
so what's
the way
the catalyst?
Just say the Buddhist way. This 12 links. Have you had teachings on the 12 links yet?
Yeah.
You have. So what the 12 links is Lord Buddha's explanation of various things that occur, starting, you know, that occur. We're basically creating these 12, thousands of these 12 links, like every day. First, there's the fundamental, on the basis of the fundamental delusion that clings to the self-existent I, this is the root of it all, we then create a karma. Every millisecond, there's an intention and an action. That karmic seed is then implanted on the third point of the 12 is the consciousness. And then because of this, this happens, and then this, and then that, and then this, and then that. So in daily life in general, 8 and 9 in this 12 links are called craving. Normally, there are sometimes different translations, and sometimes given much commentary on the meaning. But broadly speaking, there's craving and grasping, and they're simply attachment, generally speaking. Attachment is this, and again, I keep saying it, it's got this multi-facets. It's very profound state of mind, and really, the Buddha's view effectively, when it comes to understanding what our day-to-day suffering, attachment's the main cause, which is not how we think. So because of attachment, which is this constant dissatisfaction. Then because of dissatisfaction, there's craving. Then because of craving, we then manipulate to get an object. And then when you see the object, the craving makes it look much more delicious than it really is. And then you go to get the object. And then you expect the happiness to come. And then you possess it of yours. And all this drama setting up these habits. So this craving and grasping every millisecond. So roughly as Rinpoche says, you know, you're like sitting in life. You sit and relax. Then you come, this dissatisfaction pops up. Oh, what's missing, you know? You go, oh, cake. Then attachment kicks in. Attachment searches in your mind for what it is you want because you're feeling like you're missing something. Then you get all excited because you think of cake. And the mind gets all perky, isn't it? All excited. That's attachment already. Jumps in. Craving. That's craving. Then grasping kicks in that forces you to go and get it. Now, you know yourselves when you try to control yourself with eating. Just say simple. Any habit we have, we all know we're junkies for one habit or another, you know? And the thought arises, that's the beginning. And if it's very strong, you know, even though part of you is saying, I don't want to eat that cake, but you're watching yourself go over and stuff the cake in the mouth. Do you understand? That's the intense one, craving. And once that's in motion, it's very hard to stop. And you know already the cake out there, boom. Any strong habit we have, you know, if we're addicted to porn or addicted to certain habits, things, or reading the paper, before you know it, you can't stop. You're doing it. So this is happening ever so subtly every second. So at the time of death, Rinpoche says, and this is the point about the 12 links in this book, it's only related to the time of death. This particular powerful function of craving and grasping. Well, craving and grasping, and then the third one, which has always seemed so abstract, called becoming, something often called becoming. And in the second, let me just read more of what Rinpoche says. I think it's good if we read this and you'll hear what Rinpoche says about these 12 links at the time of death. We'll go back to that. Because you just have to, I'm telling you, I had never studied it. It took me 9 months to read the different teachings, to put them all together, to understand it, to try to link it, to explain, really to get it clear. We're not just empty words, because then when you just have the words but not the meaning, you make mistakes, you know? It took me quite a while. And the point Rinpoche is making is really, I've never heard this before, and many people even I've showed it to have never heard it before, the way he's been saying it. So it's really, I find, extremely helpful. It's like chapter 5 or something, I think, or chapter 7, I forget now. Where are we? My book's different. I've got 29 chapters, but Wisdom made it, and I've got five parts. They made it 5 chapters, and all the subheadings are my chapters, so I'm get a bit confused. Okay, how we go from one life to the next. I think it's in here. What happens at death? Then it's the 12 links. Here we go. Okay, so cyclic existence, I'll just read it out. Okay, we listen, okay? So it's good teaching. Cyclic existence operates through the 12 links of dependent arising. From one, ignorance, the root delusion, that believes in inherent existence, we create two, compounded action, or simply karma. Intention, followed by the action, you know? But intention is the key. And that leaves an imprint on the mind, which is number three, consciousness. And then some authors of the scriptures also count the result consciousness that enters the fertilized egg. So you have to study this to get it clear. Next they call it name and form. Number four link. Name, so this is not in every day. I mean, this doesn't happen that as, you know, this is like the way these affect each other and how they bring rebirth. But we're creating these every second. So it's a quite intricate process which you have to learn to understand. So next is name and form. Name referring to the four mental aggregates and form to the physical, the egg and the sperm, when the five come together in the womb. So in other words, this karma is referring to a throwing karma. That's what it means, because that is what creates a life. A throwing karma is the one... Okay. Like I said, there's various ways that intentional actions ripen in the future. The key one, the crucial one, this massive one here, is what they call the throwing karma, which is the one that is triggered. This is the number two link. The one that is triggered at the time of death, that throws you, as they call it, into the next life. So clearly, along with that one, in our case, a virtuous karmic seed was triggered at the time of our death that caused us to go to our mummy's human womb. And then we can deduce from the process that simultaneously that all the other trillions of karmic seeds that would ripen in that birth as our personality, in that birth as our experiences, in that birth as our environmental results, all of these were triggered. But this is the main one they talk about, the meaning, the throwing karma, the main one. So if you're going to be born a dog, then all your personality traits, all your experiences, you know, being a dog, etc., etc., all triggered then. But this second one is referring to the throwing karma. And then the main result of a throwing karma in 20, it could be 27 lifetime, not just that life. It will be what they call name and form, which is the five aggregates, which is a way Buddha divides the five components of a person. So the throwing karma produces a person, the type of rebirth.
Can I go back 1 second, or do you want to finish that?
Keep
first?
Going. What?
Because I want to go before that moment. What I'm trying to figure out is,
are you discussing the death process?
Yeah. So
okay, I'm not doing that yet. We're not there yet.
Okay.
So just wait and hear this, and then we can ask the question. I think it's good. This is just Rinpoche describing, in general, in this first paragraph, the 12 links. In general, okay? And then he gets specific about the 12 links in relation to death. Okay. So, consciousness. The karmic seed is left on the consciousness. And then next, this is what produces whenever the time is right. So, in other words, the karmic seed that's number two... here, at the time of our past death. That might have been a seed planted 1 million lives ago. Easily. Doesn't have to be that day, that life. It's highly complex. Meaning, that's why I like to use the analogy, what we're carrying around these bank vaults of trillions of throwing karmas, for example, from many lives ago. And then all the intricacy of all the conditions of that particular death, that particular one is triggered, you know? It could be from the past life, but it doesn't have to be. That's the point. Rinpoche talks about this. And then that will produce this next fourth one, which is called name and form. And name is referring to the four mental aggregates of this grouping of aggregates. And we can discuss all this, but I don't think we've got much time today. You maybe have learned about the five aggregates. Mm-hmm. We'll just say briefly, okay? Shall I say briefly? Mm-hmm. Do you want to know? Five aggregates? Briefly, okay. From a teaching of Lord Buddha, one of his sutras, that he divided a person. Well, he divided actually his two ways of looking at the five aggregates. One is it's a way of describing all the impermanent phenomena of the universe can be divided into these five, or there's our personal five aggregates. So the first one is called form, which is simply referring to physical, simply speaking. Then the next two, feeling and discrimination, are two of the five what are called always present mental factors among the 51 mental factors that's traditionally taught when you study Buddhist psychology. And this is coming from the Hindus as well. And these 51 are only 51 of the thousands of mental factors or states of mind that go on. But these 51 are plucked out in this text, particularly because they relate to a person. They're the ones that are necessary for you to understand if you want to be a practitioner. So Buddha plucks out of that one of a grouping called five always mental present factors. They're happening every millisecond because of the feeling and discrimination or recognition, or the third one we said, what was it?
Discrimination. Feeling.
The different terms we use for discrimination. Discrimination, recognition. Yeah, it's in other words, that ability of the mind to discriminate between this and this. And this is crucial if you want to be a practitioner. Then the feeling one is really powerful. We could spend an hour talking about that, but it's very fascinating. Feeling, every millisecond, we've either got a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, or a neutral feeling. There's no fourth category of feelings. And feeling is not how we talk about it. It's very specifically referring to a moment of happiness, a moment of suffering, or a moment of neither, indifferent, sort of neutral. And these are all the product of karmas. So these feeling and discrimination are crucial components that relate very strongly to the way attachment is perpetuated, the way samsara is perpetuated. So Buddha plucked these two out of all the other thousands of states of mind and gave them their own status as being two of the five aggregates, the five components of a person. Are we communicating? Just because of their crucial role in the way attachment plays out and therefore the way we create samsara. Okay? The third one, fourth one, is called, what's it called? What's the fourth one?
Compound,
or different terms. Brimache calls it, oh, he doesn't call it anything. Oh, he does later. Compound of phenomena. It basically is a grab bag of all the other leftover bits that aren't included in form, feeling, discrimination. So the other 49 mental factors are included there, and all the other bits and pieces of impermanent phenomena that aren't included in the other categories. And the fifth one is called consciousness, which confuses us because when we think of feeling and discrimination, they're both mind. But the way they use it here is it's referring to consciousness in general, like your mind stream, or what they call primary consciousness. That's right, isn't it? So we've got to learn these, we've got to study them. And there's a very particular reason Buddha plucked out these five, because you can just as easily say we're made up of two things, body and mind. Or you can say we're made of, you know, and of course in the Western model we're not made up of these at all. It's different whole kettle of fish, you know. So, but we need to study the reasons why Buddha chose those. So, name is referring to the four are mental. So consciousness, the fifth one. The first one is physical, and the rest four they say are mental. That doesn't make sense though, because what's in that grab bag of compounded phenomena? There's lots of things that aren't also consciousness, aren't there? No. Never mind. Something like that. And then form to the physical, okay, to the egg and sperm. Name and form. It's another way of describing the whole package that is coming as a result of the throwing karma. You with me, people? Okay, that's the fourth of these. And then the next one is called the six sense bases. So when they begin to, when these form and, you know, form and name and form begin to develop as the fetus, they're known as the six sense bases, okay? And that means the sixth one they're referring, not the senses themselves, but the sixth sense basis is a way we don't describe in the West. It's like a subtle physical energy that's a basis of these consciousnesses, this capacity of the mental and the five senses functioning. They have to have this sense basis, as they call it, which is like a subtle physical energy, or the mental one is the previous moment, isn't it, of the consciousness. Yeah. Okay. Then the next comes contact. This is in daily life now. On the basis of having these six senses and the sense bases, there's then contact, which is a third of these five always present mental factors, but it's not in these five aggregates though. And that contact is when the mind, when consciousness and mind connects with the external object through the sense bases of the eyes, ears, and so forth. So, you know, having senses, the second the object of eye consciousness is colour and form, colour and shape. So the second eye consciousness, on the basis of the eyeball, if you like, as we call it, goes over here and goes boom, and there's contact. Then that instantaneously produces a feeling, either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There, and this is just the way samsara works. So clearly, if there's attachment in my mind for that cup, the millisecond my eye consciousness contacts that shape and color, instantaneously it triggers a pleasant feeling. Now this is really when it's powerful understanding karma, and this is where, like, say, example of the little boy who was the fisherman. always use that example. And this is the tragedy of samsara, this whole process. This is the heartbreaking tragedy. So there's this little boy. Due to past karma, he's been in the lower realms. He exhausts the main karma of the lower realms, which is the main result of karma, of his killing. He exhausts that. But the tragedy is, he hasn't finished all aspects of the karma. So in this life, like a miracle, he gets a human birth. You know, the karma finishes, and it's from some point, from the lower realms, the throwing karma of virtue is triggered at the time of that past life, and then it throws his mind, in this case, it threw his consciousness into his California mummy's womb. Second, all his tendencies in that human life, and his mummy said he was a very nice boy with intelligence and kindness and generosity, lots of good tendencies, they were all triggered. His experiences, good, you know, nice mummy, nice daddy, good people, they liked him, lots of good experiential karma ripened, and the environmental karma also triggered, very nice. But the tragedy was, because he hadn't purified all aspects of killing, the residual results left over are the ones, the tendency to keep killing. This is the worst of the worst of the worst. Because why? Because he hadn't lived in vows of not killing, and he hadn't regretted not killing and vowed never to kill again. That's the tragedy, and that's why vows are so potent, and that's why, as Lama Zopa says, we are insane not to do the purification practice every night, because that's the tragedy. So he's ran out of his main karma of killing, he gets an amazing human life, but he completely puts it down the toilet, because what happens is this: he's just bopping along, little boy, and one day he meets fishing. He has never heard of fishing before, but suddenly what happens is like his memory is triggered. It's not really like a memory, but it's like that. That means the karmic, his tendency to kill is suddenly triggered by seeing this fishing. Instantaneously, it triggers, and this is the tragedy, this is the one of feeling, this next link. He has contact with that shape and color. It's label fishing, label killing. Instantaneously, that's the contact. It then triggers a pleasant feeling. In fact, with him, a very pleasant feeling. That's another word for happiness. And now, because at the same time, attachment was triggered. This is the utter tragedy. An attachment causes the object to look extremely delicious. So all this like millisecond happening together, you know, we don't even separate these pieces. The karmic imprint is there. He sees the object, contact is made. Attachment and all this, they work so much together, you know, because he's got attachment to it. Because his attachment to it, the habit of having done it before, it appears as delicious to him. Now his mummy, who didn't have a tendency to kill, she couldn't bear the thought of killing. She never wanted to think about it, but she was trying to be respectful to her boy. But he always asked her to go with him. One day she did. So this is the point. She sees fishing. No karmic tendency. Instantaneously, her feeling that's triggered is sadness, or is unpleasant, because she sees these poor fish suffering, you know. So he doesn't know this. He has a very pleasant feeling, and this is the point. That's called feeling. We all know, don't we, because we've got attachment, we are junkies for good feelings. Every single decision we make is to get a good feeling. We are literally, in these human bodies, these bodies of desire, these bodies created by attachment, the better way to put it is we are literally junkies for good feelings. Every decision we ever make is to trigger a good feeling. The millisecond my body gets uncomfortable, what do? I have to move my body. Why? Because I don't like unpleasant feelings. The millisecond you get too hot, too tired, too cold, too hungry, too this, you change it, because you're desperate for a pleasant feeling. The millisecond an unpleasant feeling, even a mild one, comes, we're so distressed. So we are basically junkies for good feelings. And that's this one that's called feeling, that's triggered the second you make contact via the senses with that object, sound, smell, whatever it might be. In his case, it was his fishing scenario. Attachment instantaneously was triggered. It made it instantaneously totally divine. So naturally, extremely pleasant feelings. So logically, what triggers extremely pleasant feelings also will look good, and therefore you'll call it good. And because you want those feelings again, what do you think you're going to do? You're going to go fishing again. What do you think you'll do? That's why we're addicted to things. That's why we can't even, the pathetic little habit to put food in the mouth. Because we're junkies for those feelings. And there every millisecond a feeling is being triggered. So attachment is not feeling. And feeling, nothing wrong with pleasure. Buddha says, you know what, I've got some method for you babies that will give you such pleasure you won't believe it. The tragedy is, we think, You know, we think happiness or good feelings are what we get when we get what attachment wants. And we spend our lives following it. Buddha says, you know, I've got a better method for you, honey. You, pleasure, happiness will be permanent and unchanging. And that's what you'll end up with when you give up attachment. So we've got the opposite view. We think happiness is what we get when we get what attachment wants. Happiness means pleasant feeling. He says, no, 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 that's just superficial. It's polluted, it's contaminated, it's up and down like yo-yos, and the big tragedy is it doesn't last. It turns into miserable feelings. The more you get contact with that object, we know it's true. This fisherman, he adored fishing. I guarantee if he had to fish 24 hours a day, never sleeping, he would have died of exhaustion. But we have to have a break from the eating, from the porn, from the video games, from the cake, because we get stuffed, because it turns into something ugly. Then we have a sleep and we get hungry again. We're junkies, basically. Are we communicating here?
Yeah.
Are you sure? This is samsara. Buddha calls this samsara, being junkies. So feeling is triggered every millisecond you contact an object of the senses. And it's either a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, or a junk care feeling. And we only want the pleasant ones. So we're going to search like vampires for the object that will trigger pleasure. And so of course we think it's the cause of happiness. That's why we do it. Because we want the good feelings. So torturers, pedophiles, that's why they do it. Fishermen. You know, while we eat cake, while we do television, while I read my newspapers, while I go to bed, while I get up, while I do this, everything is to trigger a good feeling. We are junkies for good feelings. And of course we deduce that the cake and the torturing and the fishing and the porn and the games and the tea and the shape and the taste are the cause. Lie. You know what the cause of good feelings is? This is the joke. This is the tragedy. What feelings are, what pleasant feelings are, another bank vault you're lugging around with you is a bank vault of virtuous seeds, okay? All these virtuous seeds we're talking about. This is what's so tragic. Every second of pleasant feeling that we experience is merely triggered by the cake, the porn, the video game, the shape, the color, or whatever. Or the fishing. It's only triggered by it. But the tragedy is the main cause of that pleasant feeling in the torturer's mind, in the pedophile's mind, in your mind, isn't cause. It's only catalyzed. But the pleasant feeling is the ripening of one of your past virtuous karmic seeds. Literally. This is too shocking for our mind. In other words, this is Buddha's view. Buddha's point is fundamental. Virtuous actions will ripen as happiness. Hear the words. What's happiness? It's a series of pleasant feelings. That's it. We think of happiness as too vague, you know. Literally, each moment of pleasant feelings you have in a day, that is a fruit of a past virtuous action. But the tragedy is, because of attachment and negative karma, we're confused and think it's the fishing that causes the pleasant feeling, the video game that causes the pleasant feeling, the food that causes the pleasant feeling, the torturing that causes the pleasant feeling. It's not. It's merely a catalyst. It's a trigger. It's kind of nightmarish to think of it this way. But any capacity to experience a pleasant feeling is because of a past virtue. And you can see how this could be true, because one day you got a terrible migraine. So what you're feeling, isn't it, is experiencing is unhappy feelings, aren't you? Serious suffering feelings. Wouldn't you agree? They're called unpleasant feelings. And what are they? They're not the headache. They're from the past karma, and your bank vault of negative actions is now ripening every single second. So you try go fishing when you got a pedophile, when you got a migraine. You try having sex when you got a migraine. You try watching video games when you got a migraine. Forget it. And even if you do have sex, it'll make your headache worse. Do you see what I'm saying? Are we communicating here? Are we communicating here?
Yes.
This is technical stuff. This is technical. We've got to learn these things. Then we'll really understand what Buddha means by how we create suffering, how we create happiness. It's technical, you know. So the tragedy is the fisherman. Okay, here he is. The residual result of his past killing, because he hadn't purified it. hadn't vowed never to kill again. And also, in his case, he hadn't purified it by having regret. So he died young. He had the experience similar to the cause. He died scuba diving when he was 29. That's the result of past killing. He hadn't purified that, so he died young. And he hadn't purified the tendency, so he spent his life killing fish, never thinking it was causing suffering. And that's the tragedy. On that boat with his mummy not having the hindrance of past habit of killing, not having the hindrance of having a pleasant feeling when he kills, all she saw was suffering. All he could see was pleasure, because his mind, his attachment, had made up this novel, this fantasy that he imposed upon the scenario called fishing, which made him as blind as a bat, and he could never see the suffering. This is the tragedy when it comes to harming sentient beings. All he saw, because it triggered good feelings in him, he was blinded. He could never see the harm he was doing. This is the tragedy of attachment, and the one of pleasant feelings on the basis of doing wrong, negative actions, you know. This is why doing the things we do following attachment, it sounds punitive to us, but this is why it is so tragic, and why it causes only in the future, can only cause suffering. Are we communicating here? So, when the mind contacts with the external object through the senses, followed by a feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, in relation to those objects, which then, this is the point, it comes first, then gives rise to craving and grasping, and like instantaneously. It all happens so quick, you know. It all happens so quick. It's like in a millisecond this is all happening. Sometimes if you wait, you know, for each piece to come. A millisecond. And we're doing millions of these a day. Because why? Because we're programmed to perfection by countless lives of doing this. All the animal lives are doing this. All the hell realm lives are doing this. All the human realm lives. All the God realm lives. We've been doing this for eons, Buddha says. Utterly, completely programmed. So to cut this process down is incredibly sophisticated, highly, amazingly technical, an amazing practice to even begin to understand this process. This is what's called creating samsara, and we're doing a million of these every day. Then the next one, they call it becoming. And then there's birth. And then there's old age and death. So let's just read what Rinpoche says. So let's discuss the 12 links in relation to this human body that we have now. What caused our consciousness to join the egg and sperm in our mother's body? What made it go there? In past lives, because of ignorance, number one, we created both non-virtuous and virtuous karma, number two, which planted seeds, left potentials in the field of our consciousness, number three. Then, at the time of death of our life before this one, whether we were human or an elephant or a kangaroo, at the time of death, craving arose. And what we've deduced when we looked at the death process, that seems to be about the time, as Pabongka Rinpoche says, before your gross consciousness ceases, which we can deduce is about the second or the third, maybe, stage of the eight stages, which is the explanation from Vajrayana. Craving to not separate from that body. That's the main intense craving. That then fear arose because of the attachment to not wanting to leave the body. Craving, attachment, same. But in this case, craving at the time of death is referring to an intensely extra powerful level of attachment. A frantic, frantic, frantic level of attachment, so powerful. And it's craving to not want to lose this, you know, frantically, panic-strickenly. Then fear arose because of the attachment to not want to leave this body. That's what causes fear at the time of death. Then after that, the next one, and then that gives rise to grasping, even more powerful. A stronger form of attachment. This time, in our case, attachment to receiving a human body. Now, in the case of someone who is going to be born in the hot hells, the craving is the same, not wanting to separate their body from their body. But the grasping is to heat. because they feel it's very cold. Many times dying people say they feel cold and beg for blankets. But even if you give them two or three, it won't be enough. Their grasping at heat is so strong. And this also could happen, Rinpoche says, because the fire element is dissolving at that point. That's why we've got to know these. I mean, even though they don't teach them in the same context, we've got to understand the eight stages, which is from Radhyana, and the 12 links, which is from the Sutra. Because these are two different processes that are occurring at the same time, although they're different models explaining the same process. You understand? The grasping at heat. This is the point about the grasping. This is the key point about this grasping. That, when that kicks in, that is the condition that triggers the karmic seed, the number two, the throwing karma. That's the one. That's the one. Precisely. That's the one. Or in other words, the way they say it, and Rinpoche doesn't mention this too much here. Well, he does a bit. I'll say it more in a minute. The grasping at heat activates a negative karmic seed, the second link, which causes their mind to migrate to a hell being's body right after death. The grasping is the close condition. There were, of course, the previously created causes. The first link, ignorance, and the second, karma. So the grasping that occurs there is a condition. It's not the main cause. You've got to understand that point. It's got a major one. Like, we think the cake is the main cause of the feeling of pleasure. The cake is merely the trigger. It's another example of a trigger, secondary causes and main causes. The cake, which appears to us, or the fishing for that boy, appears to us to be the direct cause of a pleasant feeling. And that's exactly how we live our lives. We believe this totally. Exactly like that. But it's not true. Like I said, this is shocking to hear. The main cause of that pleasant feeling, in fact, is a past karma of 57 lives ago, of virtue. A virtue. And it's like, you know, that the triggering of it is seeing the cake. The cake's a secondary cause. And this is a tragedy. Doing something, this is why doing something negative on the basis of attachment is what is the killer. But we think it's the cause of the pleasant feeling. Pleasant feeling, I'm just going off again. Pleasant feeling is not attachment. Pleasant feeling is happiness. Happiness is valid. There's nothing deluded about happiness. Happiness is a pleasant feeling. And we want bucket loads of pleasant feelings. And what Buddha's saying is, like I said before, he's got this method for us to eventually have only pleasant feelings ever. Literally. That's when you've achieved nirvana. Literally, you will only ever have pleasant feelings. When you've removed all the delusions from the mind, okay, Buddhahood, it is an impossibility to have anything but bliss. This is literal. Because there's no non-virtue left. So non-virtuous actions are what put the seeds in the bank vault of negative seeds, and they are what ripen as unpleasant feelings, which is called suffering. So the cake is a trigger, not the main cause. The fishing, the video game, the cup, the thing, the whatever, the sense objects are merely the trigger. So here, the grasping, which is intense attachment, to whatever's in, you know, if we've trained, like Rinpoche is deducing, that we've trained our mind in our past, or, no, if we were an animal, we couldn't have trained our mind. But for whatever, this is why I find fascinating, Geshe-la helped me a lot with this, to really try and imagine if you were a dog, and this grasping is to the next human life. So there must have been whatever that, I mean, that's really quite abstract. How that is, I'm trying to work it out. Do you see what I'm saying? It's very interesting. It's hard to really work that one out. There has to be grasping, Rinpoche says, even if we're a kangaroo. There has to be, that grasping was, at that moment, a grasping to a human form, a human next life. You think, how can that be? I don't know, I'm just quoting what Rinpoche says. I wish we had more commentary on it. Because at some point we've been in the lower realms, so obviously we've made the transition. We got a human birth. And this grasping has to have been at a human birth. This is me talking now. This is how I think we can really help our pets. I'm just deducing this. It's not coming from any source. I'm thinking it through. There's your pussy. There's your doggy. Dying. Suffering. Fearful. Forget the physical. Fearful. Because they know it's coming. It's this deep instinctive thing in them. But they've got you. They rely on you. You're a human. They rely on you. You make them feel safe. You stroke them. You're kind to them. You're having Buddha's mantras playing so they're feeling peaceful. But they're relying on you every second, and they can see you with their eyes. Maybe that is the one, even they can grasping at you as a human, and at the same time hearing Buddha, I'm not sure, don't be surprised, that can help trigger a virtuous seed. That's why they've got to be conscious. They've got to be conscious, you know. Not just drugged out. Or knocked off at the vet. Calling it putting them down. Use it the right word, please. Call killing them. That's just my thought there, okay? So the grasping in this case of a person who's got intense craving and then freaking out and holding on, grasping even more at heat, it triggers their mind to, you know, that triggers the, that's the kind of the thing that triggers. Then they go, okay, this one, okay, I'll just read what it says. Sorry. So in our case as humans, the very close, the close condition at the time of our past death, just before the gross consciousness ceased, was the grasping at the wish to receive a human body. In other words, in order to receive this perfect human rebirth that we have now, we must have had not only the karma of perfect morality, which is the cause of getting a human body in the first place, that has to be in the tank, and the great generosity, which is the cause of being born in a place where we can get jobs and have money and have leisure so we can practice our dharma, but also we would have had the strong desire, the grasping, the ninth link, to have a human body. When we understand that attachment to this life is never virtuous, and what that means is that attachment to that cake is non-virtuous, don't hear it in a negative way. Don't hear it in a sort of mean way, like Buddha's trying to make you miserable. Aren't I even allowed to have cake? Don't misunderstand. What he means is attachment to that cake is the grasping at it, the belief that when I get it, it'll make me happy. And that's technically not correct. It doesn't. It triggers a moment of pleasant feelings, but very soon, as you keep stuffing the cake in, it will start triggering unpleasant feelings. That's why you've got to stop. Technically, logically, if cake is the main cause of pleasant feelings, it is logical that the more you eat the cake, the happier the feelings. You'll end up getting complete orgasmic bliss. We know it's not true. So it's not wrong to say those things we do trigger good feelings, including the pedophile. It does trigger good feelings. But the way Buddha says is that because they're junky, they're totally contaminated with our craving and they can't last long. They don't last. They're not possible to last. They're not possible to last. They turn into ugly feelings. When we analyze this, we will see the truth of it. But because we're such junkies, we don't want to know, but we live in denial. We live in denial of the fact that cake makes us unhappy because we get stuffed, we eat too much, then we get fat, then we feel guilty, then we have to go on a diet. This endless drama we do, you know. We forget all that when we see the cake. We just go, oh, there it is again, it's going to make me happy, you know. Boom, in the mouth again. That's how we are, junkies, you know. So Rinpoche says, it isn't virtuous. Virtuous, and we have to hear this literally. Attachment to the cake, meaning, another way to put it, it's not helpful because it won't cause happiness. It's very simple. It won't. But this attachment is what Rinpoche is saying, and this is the bodhisattva view. It has to be. Attachment in general is a negative state of mind. It's the cause of all suffering. But we can, in other words, another way of putting it is we can use attachment by having it for something useful. It's skillful means. Even seems to be in our daily life. If you're going to have a relationship, can't you have attachment for a person who is going to help you practice dharma? For example, if you're going to have attachment to a person who wants to go and have heroin, that's not skillful for you. It's stupid. In the end, you don't need any attachment. But given that we've got it, let's use it and be attached to wise, intelligent, useful objects that can support us. It's common sense, you know. That's the point of this one. So just to be attached to other humans now in this life, that's not the attachment we're talking about here. It's attachment because it's skillful means, because this time of death is so intense and so fearful for us. But if we start thinking about, I want a human, new human rebirth, thinking about it, becoming attached to the idea, thinking about it, then when you die, that grasping will have that, and that'll you'll use that grasping to get you to leap into another decent human body. So now you can go ahead of attachment and give it all up and become, get enlightened. So it's a skillful means, using it to get a good result. Does that make sense? It's skillful means, you know. So when we understand that attachment to this life is never virtuous, again, don't hear it as punitive. It literally means it's not. It doesn't work, because you won't get happiness. You won't get happiness. You'll get a moment of it. But it's a honey-covered razor blade, because it slowly becomes the gross suffering of being stuffed. And then not only that, you're sowing more negative seeds in your mind, which will ripen as further suffering in the future. You know, that's the way it works, technically. And we understand that but then we can understand the function, but attachment at the time of death, which is grasping, at either a human birth or rebirth in a pure land, is virtuous. It's still a negative act. It's still a negative state of mind. You want to get rid of it, and you will eventually. But we can use it, you know. We can use it. Then we can understand the function of this link of grasping at the time of death. In other words, whereas, this is another thing he's saying, whereas craving and grasping are certainly operating in our daily life in the form of attachment, in the context of the 12 links, they are more to do with the connection of one life to the next. The karmic seed that gives rise to the new rebirth is there on our mind, the second link, but it's grasping that activates its ripening. And that's why, at that period when the death process starts, that is the crucial time when you are needed most. That's it. That's the one to help the person be peaceful and virtuous. That's it. So important. To summarize, 5 of the links are causes from past lives. 3 delusions, the 3 links of ignorance, craving and grasping. They're there from past lives. And 2 karmas, the links of compounded action, which is number 2, and this tenth one, which is called becoming. This is a curious one. So, first there was the delusion, ignorance, the root delusion, ego grasping, the first link. Then the delusions arising at the time of death, the 8th, craving, and the 9th, grasping. Then there were the 2 karmas, the second link, in our case, a virtuous karma, which could have been created thousands, even millions of lives ago. And the second karma, becoming, the 10th link. What that is this. The previously created karmic seed, number 2, made ready by craving and grasping at death. That's what's called becoming. It is these 5 that formed these aggregates, this body and mind, this samsara. Of the 7 results that manifest in this life, the 11th link, birth, this is very interesting, the 11th link, birth, started at the moment our consciousness joined the fertilized egg. That's what's called birth, according to the 12 links. Old age, listen to this, birth was the first second in your mother's womb. Old age began at the second second. Yeah. Downhill from the second second of conception. You're on the way to death. And as he says, so of the beginning of the 12th, old age and death started the next moment in the womb. Old age is not just what is known in this world, the wrinkles and the white hair and so forth. Now, all there is left is death. Old age started the second of conception. I have this tendency. I have to be so careful. I see a brand new baby, and I almost have to refrain from saying, "Oh God, it's nearly dead already." I have to be careful, you know. It's too shocking. You understand? So that section, you can study that real deep, I tell you. That took me so... I actually, like, it's my book. I'm so disgusting. It's not my book. I had to understand it to even put it together, you know, to edit it. And I still pray I haven't made mistakes. It's only 2 pages, that bit. It took me 9 months to get it clear from Rinpoche's teachings, I tell you. So I pray I haven't made mistakes and misrepresented Rinpoche because it's his teachings. So from this evolution, we can understand that if we had freed ourselves of delusions and karma in the past, there is no way we could have come into existence. There'd be no reason at all to have taken this human body, to have to experience the suffering of rebirth, the suffering of sickness, the suffering of old age, and the suffering of death, not to mention all the other problems that we experience in daily life that are not included in these four. Because we didn't cease delusions and karma in our past life by following the path, this self, this person, is still caught up in samsara. Wherever our consciousness goes, this self goes with it. Because consciousness is the main base for the existence of self. And we're talking, of course, the conventional self here. Don't get carried away and think it was an inherent self. Not that one. The gross body exists for a short time and then disintegrates. As long as this self is bound by delusions and karma, there is no choice. We will be burdened by these aggregates. Delusions and karma have bound this self to samsara, and no matter how much we do not want this suffering, as long as we are caught up in samsara, there is no freedom. Okay, any questions from that? Now, Jill, what's your question? Well, did your answer come from this or not?
Yeah. So, I guess it's kind of hard to pull it out now. So, if is it literally like right before? I guess I'm looking for timing. So, I'm dying, and my good friend's here with me. My daughter's in the room, and I grasp at my daughter, right? So, I go, Rinpoche, you know, and I start remembering Geshe-la, Bodhicitta, daughter, you know, food, or not food anymore. Life,
sure,
and I'm grasping.
That's your craving. So, that's your holding on. Craving.
So all this, everything that's arising, have come
in your mind.
Right. In my mind. All the grasping that's arising.
The attachment.
Yeah, all the attachment that's happening. And it's not an elusive, clear mind. It's because I'm almost dead. So it's from a previous moment of mind that's caused that to come. So if I think of Rinpoche, it's from a previous moment of mind. I think everything's from a previous moment. So I'm looking...
Well, in other words, putting it that way, it's simply the tendency you've practiced strongly.
Right.
If you've mainly practiced attachment, you'll forget Rinpoche. If you've mainly practiced your virtue, you'll remember Rinpoche. So yeah, that's a tendency.
She's trained your Rinpoche tendency in my ear.
Exactly, that's right.
So, and there's pictures, because you all have done that for me.
That's right.
So the throwing karma, though, is like it's just the last one, the last moment, or that's what I'm looking for.
It's the catalyst. But I said it's in here. It's in the teachings. That's what I said. This is what Rinpoche says.
Biggest grasping.
What?
The last biggest, the most heaviest grasping at the last moment is the throwing.
No, not the last moment at all. Nothing like the last moment.
Looking for the pre.
It's in here, though. So as you study it, you'll see. So this is happening, and what? Okay. This is what we discussed yesterday, the death process. So I'll go back to it to answer your question. Go back to the death process, which is chapter 8, I think, or 9. Here we go. Chapter 10. Chapter 9. The 8 stages, according to Vajrayana. Okay? Okay? Clear? All right. The very first one. Your eye consciousness ceases. Your capacity to hold a lot of information in your mind ceases. Your earth element ceases. And then you have the vision of the mirage. And your mind's already getting weaker, you know. Second, feeling dissolves, meaning less distinction between pleasant, pain, and indifference. Okay? You're losing the plot. Ear consciousness is beginning to cease. I mean, your gross consciousness is getting less and less capable. At this point, your dying thoughts activate the karmic seed that determines your next rebirth. At this point, you're losing the plot, but you're still able to put two and two together. At this point. Mm-hmm. You're not dead yet. You still can move your body. Your body hasn't become stopped yet. Your eye consciousness, even by now, your eyes might not open and close. So it seems around this time, when you're losing the plot, that this is when the craving and grasping are strong. So, as Prabhupada Rinpoche says, that's in now, after the second stage, we've inserted this. As Prabhupada Rinpoche says, in liberation in the palm of your hand, your dying thoughts, and this is about now, activate the karma that will be the cause of your next rebirth. And the activators of this throwing karma are the eighth and ninth links. Rinpoche says specifically, grasping the ninth. That's the final trigger. And that's happening about now. When you look and think a little bit, put two and two together. He says, it's as discussed, you know, that this takes place, Rinpoche says, Padmanabha Rinpoche says, while the mind is still active and can still recall virtue or be reminded of it by other people. And that's now. This doesn't mean you haven't got craving before, but these links seem to be the one, this is when they're kicking in. This is when they're kicking in. And before you lose the plot, that's when, why, when you see people who are going through this process and they're seeing, they're looking into the distance like there's some blissful thing they're looking at, like Steve Jobs one, or people dying blissfully, because already their mind is going through the process, their grosser mind is ceasing and therefore their subtle is becoming more prevalent, they can like see their next life. And it's like blissful. And those who had, and that means, you can deduce, that means that karmic seed has already been triggered. A virtuous one. You can see the sign of it. Do you see? You have to put all these things together. They don't spell it out like this exactly, but you can deduce it. Because if you're seeing and looking blissful like this, your mind's still functioning, and already the mind's getting less, that has to have been the positive seed has been triggered. That's why you're seeing blissful things. But if you're freaking out and clinging and grasping and vampires and horror and demons and sheep coming at you, this implies, and your body's still moving. Your body's moving, that's why you're freaking out. Your body's moving, which means you haven't got to the fourth point yet, which means your mind is still functioning, but now the karmic seed that is triggered is a negative one. You see your future life coming, the nightmare, the next lower realms. So all of this points to how all this is occurring before you stop breathing. This is when craving and grasping kick in. And the grasping is the trigger that then is the one that is the trigger for the second. Craving and then grasping. So our craving could be for my daughter, my beloveds, but then you remember your virtue, you remember your guru, you hear the words, and the next one is the grasping, which happens spontaneously, and you think of your future life, you think of the Pure Lands, and that'll help you go, shh, there. So you divert the process, you know. Do you understand? Is that clear, people?
Yes.
Yes. Microphone.
Venerable Rabina.
Yes.
I'm over here. Hi.
Where? Okay, go.
So we've been talking a lot about how to help someone when they're on their deathbed.
That's right.
How do we help someone who has that sudden death or violent death?
Okay, I understand.
And then we come upon...
I know. That comes later in the scenarios. Once the person's dead... So all of this commentary is the typical one the lamas give for a person who's dying gradually. We have to learn all this, you know? Then... Once the person's mind has stopped, we have to put different sections, different scenarios. So what to do if your loved one dies at home? Assumption being maybe 3 days. What to do if your loved one dies in hospital? Assumption half an hour if you're lucky. Do you understand? Before you have to give the body away. What to do if your loved one dies suddenly? And what to do if your loved one gives the organs? They're the four main scenarios, I'd say, you know? So then the one of sudden, none of this is occurring, of course. That's why you've got to rely on the good life. But this is much more powerful because there's not much you can do in that period. And then this is why, again, for the sudden one, we have to have education. Because the second a person's dropped dead in their soup or they vomit on the floor or in a car accident, we have a panic attack. So to keep your mind steady then is not that easy. To know how to deal with that right that second. Whether you try to make them come alive again, whether they're really dead, it's really quite traumatic for most of us. So there's very little you can do for that person because if they're, you know, like... Who was it? Somebody I heard recently. It was shocking. Yeah, Miles Davis. I nearly cried when I read this. I'm a total fan of Miles Davis. I'm a complete fan of Miles Davis. But this I found heartbreaking. He had intense anger. Apparently. Brilliant being. I adore Miles Davis. And I read that he died because he got raging angry when something didn't happen. And he literally had a stroke and died. I mean, my heart broke for him, straight to the lower realms. Pretty much. He died from getting raging angry. He caused himself to have a heart attack, a stroke or a heart attack. A heart attack, I think, and he died. Now, that's really intense. Then you could just be sitting there, you know, eating your dinner, annoyed with somebody. You can be sitting there feeling radiantly blissful and compassionate for somebody, and you die suddenly. So it's like Russian roulette, dying suddenly. Because whatever's in your mind at that moment, unfortunately, is the trigger. And this is the part, and it always seems so mean to us. You mean I can live a good life and then go to the hell realms? That's not fair. Well, fair has nothing to do with it. You can be driving perfectly for 40 years and still die of a car accident. We know that. It's not a question of fair, you know. There's no one judging it. It's our own karma ripening. Which is why it's not enough just to be a nice person. It's not enough just to even live in vows. You've got to do purification as well, because that gets ahead of the game. That clears the weeds, so that when you do die, you can be more likely to have a virtuous karma seed triggered, you know. That's why all these fundamental practices in daily life are so crucial. Do you understand? And all the practices to do are the same practices. You see, Rinpoche, when he teaches, he doesn't teach at chronological levels. We have to make it chronological, because that's what suits us. It's much better. The same practices, whether they die suddenly, whether they do this. It's all the King of Prayers, Medicine Buddha, put a mantra on their head, do this, do that. It's the same. But you have to put the scenarios, because that helps our mind. Do you understand what I'm saying? And we'll go into those in a minute, okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Are we communicating? This book blew my mind, I tell you. I was so happy to do it. I was so excited, you can hear. Well, I was always excited, aren't I? I know. Okay, we'll keep going. The different practices are due different times. Okay? So we were discussing, we went this yesterday, what to do, you know, the weeks and months before. So all the different types of practices, which they mentioned so many, you know? As we were discussing, all the things to see, all the things to touch, the prayer wheel, the blessing string, the text, the prayers on your body, the stupa, the text, that's all in that first section. Then what to hear, you know, so many things, what to hear, what to see, the pictures, the stupas, the statues, the prayer wheels, your guru's photo, Jesus, whoever turns you on, you know. My friend who's lying in bed, she's got them on her roof, on her ceiling. Then the next section is what to think about. What to think about. What to think about. Make sure your loved one has given away their possessions. It's called a will, but it's really helpful for the person, you know, to stop the clinging to their things, or they're happy to have given them away. Of course, if your mummy's really manipulative and wants to divide the family and is obsessed with what she's giving away, she's going to have more attachment, unfortunately. People do that, sometimes play games with their will and everything, to, you know, whatever. But giving it away can release you from it all, which is so important. Talk about your loved one's guru, or Buddha, or God, as I said. You know, whatever works for your mummy's mind. Talk about heaven to the Christians. Just rave on about how lovely heaven is. How so delicious, so beautiful, so peaceful, and God is there, and he adores you, and it's one. In other words, this is the point. When we understand attachment, one of its powerful functions is to look forward to something. Okay. This is why the craving of death is so terrifying, because it's not looking forward to anything, it's holding on to what we've got. But if you can train your mind, which is really like the grasping, to look forward to something, then you can be skillful for their mind, you know. You release the attachment to now, and you look forward to the next bit, which is what we do every day. We're always looking forward to something. And that can be what's so neurotic about us. We can never sit for one second. Our mind's racing ahead. But this is when it's good. This is like a miracle for people's mind. If they've had faith in God, you know. Okay, of course, for us Buddhists too. But for your mummy. And like I said to you, maybe they haven't thought about God for years. But remind them, they might be delighted. They're desperate to find something to hang on to. They'll be so relieved to remember God, but they haven't got enough strength to think of it themselves. So be brave, bring it up. If they tell you to go away and don't talk about God to me, then okay, you learn they don't want God. But don't be scared about it. Do you hear my point? Of course, it's Buddha, the Guru, all these things. You know, so important. It loosens the heart, relaxes the mind, and your attachment, your craving, your fears, all go onto that. It could such skillful means. Talk about your loved one's good qualities. This is incredible. We can only find a bit of Rinpoche saying it, you know. But it's really clear. It's important to emphasize all the good, the positive things the person has done during their life, and not dwell on what they consider to be failures. Tell them you have a good life, sincere. You've done many good things. This is an incredible thing to do for your loved ones. You know, look at our own neurotic minds. We're always thinking what we didn't do. So much guilt, so much fear, so much negative. Just start telling a person they've done good things. They'll turn into bliss. They'll be so happy to hear it. Praise the person. And like someone said yesterday, even though they've been a mean mummy, don't worry. Lie to them. Tell them they've been a good mummy. It'll lift their heart. If they're brave enough, you know. This is the most amazing gift to a person. Tell them their good qualities. What a good mother, what a good father, what a kind person you've been. And if they want to say sad things, let them say it. Don't deny, you know. But tell them the good things. It's okay. You know, you've done a good... And that's relief. The relief is immense. And again, lifts their mind, makes them virtuous. Talk about compassion, bodhicitta. And this is very much according to the person's capacity, you know. His Holiness says that the best way to die is to die with the thought of benefiting others. A self-supporting death, His Holiness calls it. I mean, this is really high, it seems to me, you know. I can't imagine when you're dying, suffering there, lying there dying and suffering, you start thinking about being kind to others. I think that's too much to ask, in my opinion. But maybe some people really are like that, you know. Do you understand? I can't imagine it. And then you're dying, your friend starts telling you, you know, Ruche says, tell them there, you can tell them with this, okay, it's your responsibility to help your loved one develop compassion. To be thinking of the happiness of others as they die, rather than their own terrible circumstances, is an amazing thing to do. Compassion is the ultimate attitude to take to the next life. If the person could remember this, without one single doubt, they will be saved from the lower realms. To die like this is wonderful. You can tell them that with this attitude they use their death to achieve enlightenment for others. I'm sorry, my mind is not that high. If you start talking about it, I say, shut up. I'm suffering. I can't imagine a person being so high. But if you are, then wow, go for it, you know. Their bodhicitta brings all the happiness. I mean, this is because Rinpoche's got this kind of mind, so he sees it as the best thing, you know. And that's what I heard from Rinpoche. You could observe it. When Rinpoche had this stroke, you know, like, what was it, 4 years ago? 6 years ago. When was it? What year was that? 12. I can't remember. I was there in Bendigo at the centre, Atisha Centre, when Rinpoche had this stroke. And people, they took him off to the hospital, to the Catholic, local Catholic hospital. And Roger stayed there the whole time, Sungpo stayed there the whole time, Dan Knight with him, you know. And people said that, like, even though we saw the next morning, Roger started video, and we saw this video of Rinpoche after his stroke, he sounded like a drunk, senile person. Do you understand? His face was all puffed up, but he was laughing the whole time. It was like he was a wacko mad person. He couldn't speak, he was completely drunk, he couldn't hear any words, he couldn't walk, but apparently he was like blissful, laughing. His Holiness, when he had a meeting with His Holiness, someone told me he was there. And Sunpo, who's his little kind, he's like his little butler, a really close connection, this young monk who just takes care of every second of Rinpoche's needs, you know? Very sweet, calm, steady boy. Very beautiful boy, it seems. So, His Holiness was with Rinpoche and Sungpo was there, and he was stroking Rinpoche's right arm and being so kind to him. And he said, when did you first notice you had the stroke? And Rinpoche said, well, when Sungpo laughed at me. So Sungpo, suddenly, Rinpoche started slurring his words, you know. Rinpoche, Sungpo burst out laughing. We go, oh my God, what's happening? He burst out laughing, you know. Anyway, whatever, they fixed him. And then His Holiness says, oh, that's not good, laughing at your guru. And then he said, oh, of course, it's really nice showing close connection between the disciple and the guru, you know. But Rinpoche apparently was like this over-the-top, suddenly extra levels of incredible compassion. His response to the suffering. He was laughing. He was like joyful. And these Catholic nuns were shocked. They'd never seen anything so weird in their lives. Most people have drama and have counselling and are freaking out and are panic stricken. People are crying. Everyone was, all these monks, these people laughing, you know. We would say stumbling, couldn't talk, doing his swimming in the thing with his, you know, little kind of thing. And he'd talk about how he thought about the people who'd use the pillow, the people who'd use the cushion, the people who'd use the sheet. He just never stopped talking about compassion. So you can see a person that level, it's genuine, you know. You don't pretend. It just boggles my mind, I tell you. It's a way to go. We can aspire to it. The next lot are what to hear. I tell you, this chapter took me 47 years. Rinpoche has come up with mantras that no one on earth has heard of, you know. He finds them in the most obscure sutras, and he's so delighted. He quotes you what Buddha says, and then, of course, he gives them all these different names, and all the poor Sanskrit scholars can't find where it comes from. And so it's just so long to sort of work out which ones. I mean, it took me, so I can't describe how long it took just to get this list of mantras. So the first one, the best one he always says is hear the names of the Buddhas. Recite the names of the seven medicine Buddhas, he says. There's a practice in which you visualize the main medicine Buddha and six others, and which includes the prayer of the seven limbs. There is an entire sutra, the Medicine Buddha Sutra, that describes the unbelievable benefits of the Medicine Buddha practice. I think, you know, the Medicine Buddha promised that whoever chants his name or mantra will have all their prayers and wishes fulfilled. In the past, when the Medicine Buddha was a bodhisattva with unbearable compassion that encompasses all our sentient beings, he made countless prayers to pacify our many problems. Therefore, all the prayers that the Medicine Buddha made in the past will now be fulfilled. I heard a story about someone who was very sick and could not move his body. He was alone in the house. His medicine was in the bathroom, and he was unable to get off his bed to fetch it. Lying there, thinking about how to get his medicine, he turned his head towards the Medicine Buddha statue on his bedside table, and there was his medicine in the hand of the Medicine Buddha. These are such sweet stories, aren't they? You know, if you're cynic, you think they're ridiculous. Never mind. You can believe it or not, I don't care. Then you can recite the 35 Buddhas confession. Then you can hear mantras. Many, this is all this endless mantras. It is good to chant or play mantras so the dying person can hear them. This can lift them from sadness or depression. In general, all mantras are very powerful. Simply hearing them can purify negative karma and protect them from the lower realms. So this is the one about your cat, your dog, the ant, the mouse, your senile grandma, the baby. You know, if you can, the most precious gift, according to Rinpoche, but you can give them. You can't talk about things, they're gone, they lost the plot, you know. They may be in a coma. But you can just have CDs, even if you're animals, especially 24 hours a day, pleasant sound, mantras quietly, subtle. So even though they're in a coma, it can only benefit their mind. You can't give them a better gift. You can't get the dog to create virtue. You can't get your poor old senile grandma to create virtue. But this puts deep imprints and it hooks the Buddha. The Buddha can be there, you know. Like I told you, my friend in coma for a couple of weeks, and all I said every now and again in her ear was, Judy, Tsongsa Khenche Rinpoche is praying for you. I said the name of her guru, you know. And that was the only thing she remembered when she came out of her coma. Jeffrey Hopkins, you know, the professor. When I did my first issue of Mandala in 95, I interviewed him. He got Lyme's disease, and he was in a deep coma. They didn't think he'd come out alive, and he had to come out and learn to speak and everything again. But he said the only thing he could remember in that chaos in his mind was Manjushri's mantra, Omarabhasanadi. He said Ling Rinpoche always said to him, never forget this mantra. The only thing he could find in his mind was the mantra of Manjushri. So, you know, maybe, you know, if you have faith in the Buddhas, this is the power of the Buddhas, the power of the holy beings. This is why it's such a stupendous gift. And even if you, this is the one about helping your animals. We love our animals. We give them insurance, we give them calves, livers, we give them doctors, we give them God knows what. But you go to work, you leave them in their ignorance for 8 hours. All you've got to do is turn on a CD, turn on a computer, and have them hear mantras all day. You can't wish to give them a better gift. The imprint is incredible for their mind. And remember the Buddha's view about karma. There's not a millisecond of anything that any sentient being sees, hears, touches, tastes, smells, or thinks about that leaves their mind. It all goes in it. You're programming in their mind. So guarantee that it blesses them now, and the Buddha will grab them at the time of death and take them to the next life. Don't be surprised. Hear mantras. Millions of them. All these special mantras. Which gives the benefit of everyone, you know. There's a special mantra which he says, the mantra for alleviating fear or pain. There's another, recite the name mantra of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, or your guru's mantra. Recite the name mantras of the Buddha who protects from the lower realms. There's another one, he's got a special job. Recite other mantras, such as Amitabha Buddha's. Recite the 10 powerful mantras. Recite the Compassion Buddha, Mother, the Compassion Buddha, Medicine Buddha, Wish Granting Will Grant, Mitugpa, Namgelma, Padmasambhava, Kunrig, Milarepa. Unfortunately, for my mind, these are the names Rinpoche gives, but Wisdom has used all the Sanskrit names, which Rinpoche never uses. So you're going to have to sort of get used to these Sanskrit ones, because that's the correct way to do it, apparently. But in this version here, which is the free PDF, got Rinpoche's names. So you have to get used to that. Here's sutras. There's a particular sutra apparently called the Great Noble Sutra on entering the gate of Vaisali is to help alleviate pain. It's really said to be that, very powerful. Recite the Heart Sutra, recite the Vajrakata Sutra. All these are in the book. All these are in the book. Play recordings of videos of teachings. Absolutely, if a person's got a guru, absolutely have one on day and night. Hearing that quietly in the background, hearing the voice of their guru. You couldn't, again, wish for a better gift to the dying one. What to meditate on. And, you know, there's Recite the medicine Buddha practice. This is one Rinpoche really recommends. Meditate using stupas. Rinpoche has written a sweet little meditation you can guide for your loved one about healing and light coming from the sutra. Meditate on Tonglen, giving and taking. He says that's for really the brave people, you know. Meditate on the death process. He goes through the death process, training their mind to get familiar with it. It's in the book. Sleep meditations. You sleep in the lion position. It's all explained how to do that. Meditate on the process of going to sleep, which is similar to the death. Sleep with bodhicitta. Sleep in the guru's lap. There's a very sweet way to think of going to sleep in your guru's lap, you know. Sleep with emptiness. A very sweet meditation which I gave about that. Meditate on the emptiness of death. Meditate on the emptiness of the mind. Help your loved one with their daily practices. That's a really powerful one. If people got commitments, you want to have a person reading them for them, or have them on a tape recording, a CD, you know. I mean, I recorded all my prayers on my iPod. So, you know, having your own prayers every day, hearing them, even if you're unconscious, it goes in deep, you know. Help your loved one, and then help your loved one practice POA, if that's their practice. They can do POA themselves, if they've got that initiation. Then what to do to purify negative karma? The different practices, you know. The negative karma that we've already created is what causes fear. So in order to not be afraid of death, for it not to be frightening, we need to purify our negative karma. The purification practices are the solution. Then we will have a happy death, and it will be much easier to attain liberation and actualize enlightenment. You can lead your loved one in various purification practices, depending on their level of practice. Prostration to the 35 Buddhas, the practice of Vajrasattva and the four opponent powers. If they've taken a highest tantra initiation, you could help them with other practices, such as Samaya Vajra, which is a particular practice of purifying our broken commitments, in the book. And the offering of Tog, especially powerful, Rinpoche says, that's in the book. And if they have completed the deity's retreat and the fire puja, one of the most powerful ways for them to purify is to take a self-initiation. This is not in the book. It purifies everything. General negative karma, particular negative karma, as well as the vows of individual liberation, bodhisattva vows, tantric vows, and commitments. When you lead your loved one in these practices, it is very important to remind them to generate strong faith that they have purified the various negative karmas, broken vows, obscurations collected from beginningless time. How much we purify depends on how much faith we have that we have purified. This is very interesting to us, because it just sounds like religion to us. But you think of this as logical. The word for faith is really the word confidence. You know, when we hear confidence, we sort of feel like adults. But faith sounds like, you know, superstition. But confidence is really obvious. If you do any, think about this. If you're driving a car with no confidence, you'll be really hopeless driver, won't you? And you'll have crashes. But if you drive with confidence, guess what caused you to drive well? Confidence. It makes it successful. So when you really do your purification, because you have to remember, it's not the Buddha that purifies. It's your mind using the Buddha that purifies you. The Buddhas will do a role for sure, but you do it. So your powerful confidence as you do the recitation, your confidence when you do the visualization, that is what purifies you. It's your mind that purifies you. But we have this self-existent view, well, I'm negative. What do you mean confident I'm purifying? I'm negative. Well, of course nothing will change. There's no negativity that can't be purified, because negativity also is empty. It's dependent arising. Purify with Samaya Vajra. Purify with Vajrasattva. Purify with 35 Buddhas. Purify with abbreviated offering of Tog. It's in the book. Tog by Lama Yeshe to Vajrasattva. Very sweet practice Rinpoche wrote. Lama Yeshe wrote in the book. And the self-initiation is not in the book, but you have to have that one for your own loved one. And finally, what to do during the hours before death. So all of those practices, you know, can be done at any time, but these are the ones you'd select over the period, according to your needs of your loved one. You select, you've got to select what's right for them. That's why you've got to be educated in this. And finally, what to do during the hours before death. First of all, be quiet. Now that death is close, it is extremely important, essential, that your loved one is not disturbed. Do not create any situation that disturbs their mind. This is the main point. Helping them avoid strong attachment and the other delusions during this time gives them a chance to have virtuous thoughts. If they have a peaceful, happy mind, they'll have a peaceful, happy death. Only the sounds of prayers and mantras should be heard. Now, this is why hospitals are so difficult. I'm not being mean about poor old nurses and doctors. They do such a good job. But it's not a conducive place to die. clearly. So difficult, you know. Because you have your own private room. Really stressful. Recognize the stages of death. That means you've got to become familiar with it, so you've got to start to see what's going on. It's not easy. You have to learn it, know it. Have your loved one lie in the lion posture. This is something you can do already. You can have the bed facing the right direction if you've thought of this one, you know. But this is not, you could also do this now, if it suits the person and everything. So here now is when you would offer a mani pill from His Holiness. This is in this little box called the Liberation Box, which you've got here. And also get it from FEMT when you buy your own. It's got a stupa in it, which you can use to put on your loved one's body beforehand. It's got a little card with mantras on it you put on your loved one's body. It's got a blessing string you put around on the body of your loved one. It's got a pill, a blessed pill, one of these mani pills. It's got a little text, a miniature text from which they really likes to put on their body as well. A few little things. It's like a little kit, you know, your death kit. So offer mani pill. As advised in this particular book which it uses, it's good to give the person who is dying a mani pill. This blesses and purifies your loved one's mind, helping them generate virtuous thoughts. You should crush the pill, mix it with water, and put a little into your loved one's mouth, making sure they swallow it. Chodron Rinpoche says it's important to do this before the outer breath has stopped. The outer breath is the gross breath. Because after that you shouldn't touch the body. So these pills contain many blessed substances and relics of enlightened beings, bodhisattvas and great yogis. They've been blessed with the prayers of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the actual compassion Buddha, for the benefit of sentient beings. And many great lamas, meditators and sangha have also prayed day and night for many days, continuously blessing them. You can give the pills to children and people who don't have the ability to understand, as well as to animals. But it's got to be before they stop breathing, because you've got to swallow it. Offer a relic of the Buddha. That's often, people don't have one of those, but it's a similar idea, you know. Think. There's different things. To think, see. Here, think about. So here, you know, if you love the Buddhist, you really focus in on the practices you're going to do. And the main one here is to talk about the guru. Or the Buddha that they like most. Or their deity. Whichever they feel, you've got to know the person's mind. Or if it's Jesus, talk about Jesus. See things. What they can still see, you know. Show them images. Have them images, pictures, mantras, etc. Touch them with holy objects, texts. All these are practices mentioned already, but these are recommended here. You know, any one of these or all of these, up to you to decide. You could have a group of monks and nuns or friends join you to do practices such as medicine Buddha, recite mantras or any of the practices below, making sure that your loved one can hear the recitations. You know, all these different practices you could do. It's just listing the Rinpoche's practices, but recommending, and you select the ones you want from this. Hear the names of the Buddhas. Hear the mantras. Do the practice, the usual thing. But also at this point, and you can do this earlier, you can, you know, organize mantras, monasteries or groups of friends outside, not here, to do special prayers and practices. People all do that very much, you know. And in the back of the book, in all these different practices where they're mentioned, hopefully in there too, it shows the websites and the things, that you, how you can do these kind of things, you know, whom to locate. Now, the practices to do during the hours and days after the breath has stopped. So the first thing, what to do as soon as the breath stops. Do not touch the body. Now that your loved one's breath has stopped, apart from putting the blessed substances on the crown, this is coming in a minute, this is next practice coming. This is what they do after the breath has stopped. We'll describe it in a minute. It's possible that touching the wrong part of the body before the mind leaves can disturb the person. Look, one practice they always do, this is very traditional among the Tibetans, if you're lying there, let's say Jill, and she's lying there, shout the name of her guru in her ear. It sounds very funny, doesn't it? Don't be polite, you know. Even what I found when people are on lots of drugs and they're in the hospital, I went to one person one time, it was the same time that Lama Zopa was in hospital, and this guy was a Buddhist, his wife was there with him in the room, she wasn't a Buddhist, but he was zonked out on all these drugs, you know, so you had to scream at him for him to sort of come out of his torpor, so he can begin to hear you, and he wanted to hear the prayers, so we shouted the prayers at him, you know, can you hear me, Steve, I said, he kind of, just you sort of saw him kind of come out of his torpor to show that he could hear you. They need to hear it. Don't be polite. Don't be all silent. Except when it's not the prayers. Don't scream at them otherwise. Shout. This is when they stop breathing. First thing, shout the guru's name in their ear. It's very funny. It sounds funny, doesn't it? Next one is touch with blessed substances. On the crown. Here. At the crown chakra. So like we talked, you know, in the Vajrayana model, they've got 72,000 subtle channels, and the central channel is just in front of the spine. So if it went all the way up, and it's end about right at the back, at the back of the head. Okay, you can kind of get a sense of where it is about there. So you'd either have a poa pill, an inner offering pill, a mani pill, or sand from a kala chakra mandala. All these blessed things, you know, you'd have many of these in advance. So you'd use butter or honey to help them stick. And doing this helps your loved one's consciousness go to the crown chakra when the time for it is to leave, because then it can leave from here. And this is when, if it leaves from here when the time is ready, it will go to a pure land. If it leaves from there. The poa pill, there's all these things. He talks about the pills, okay? You can read about these. But then Roger says, you know, it's very practical. Once you've used it and they're dead, you can take it off and put it back in your bag and use it for the next dead person. Mm-hmm. All right? Be practical. Little kit, you know. Mm-hmm. Request a lama to perform poa. So this poa, many people do it themselves. And then some people, you can get other people to do it. Typically a lama. And this is the time you get them to do it. And you're supposed to tell them what the direction the person is facing, and assuming the person has wanted this, you then ring the lama, call the lama, email the lama, say, now time. They're facing north, their head's facing this way, they died at this time, then they can do poa, and that can help their consciousness leave through the crown, specifically, to go to a pure land. It can't be before they stop breathing, though. That's why you can't do this on people who are going to have their organs taken out, because they're still alive. Their breath is still there, you know. Unless... anyway, Rimshi doesn't mention that, what to do. There was a lama in Tibet, this is interesting, where they were living and he was forced their consciousness out. So maybe high lamas can do that for people, but Rimshi doesn't mention that. Okay, I'm sorry, I'll read what I mean and then I'll explain. There was a lama in Tibet who heard that some people were going to be executed by the Chinese. He somehow managed to get the execution delayed. God knows. And then sat in meditation and did the practice. And the people waiting to be executed simply collapsed in a heap, their consciousness having left their bodies. So I'm wondering why that can't happen for... I'm speaking now. I wonder why that can't happen for a person who's having their organs cut out. Do you see what I'm saying? If they're that good. But Rinpoche doesn't mention it, so we couldn't say it. But maybe I'll ask him next time when we do a second edition, we can stick it in. It seems good if you've got a lama who can do that. They didn't need the bullets of the Chinese soldiers. And the lama not only saved the people from whatever rebirth was awaiting them, he also saved the soldiers from the negative karma of killing. When there's a very strong connection between the dying person and their guru, it is possible in some circumstances that the guru can help their mind move away from negativity and towards virtue, even if the person's mind is in an intermediate state. In other words, even if negative karma had been triggered when they passed away and they're programmed to go to a lower realm rebirth, and they're even in the intermediate state, the power of the lama's mind can help. Like I told you the story about Geshe Lama Konchog, this outrageous yogi, you know, with the fisherman. You've heard this story, some of you, but I'll tell you the end of the fisherman story. How come I knew this story was because she came in tears at Kopa, this is 25 years ago, telling me about the death of her boy 5 years before, and she explained he'd been spent his life fishing. And she'd been hearing Lama Zopa teach about karma, and she was very distressed. Well, where's he been reborn, she said. So I said, well, I don't know, but go and talk to Geshe Lama Konchog. And these lamas normally don't tell you what they see, the ones who are totally clairvoyant, who are really powerful. But he's very direct and sees what's beneficial. So he said, so she told him his name, the son's name, and he said, ah, yes. This is what clairvoyance is. He said, oh yes, he said, I use the analogy, and it's a cute one, but it's very profound. It's like I say, he accessed his Google, you know. And this is the power of people's minds. The Buddha's view is that our minds do retain everything we ever see, hear, taste, touch, smell. It's just that we don't remember it, we're thick as posts, you know. Because at the gross level, we can't. But that's all stored there. So as you remove the obstacles from your mind, you can access your memory. This is literally how you get clairvoyance. It's nothing mystical. It's all based on the view of the mind being not physical, and this view of karma, that whatever we see and taste and touch and smell and think about leaves an imprint in the mind. When you get that, then it's not illogical to imagine as you remove the obstacles, you access more and more your past, more and more you see the minds of others, their past karma, and these great holy beings completely can have perfect clairvoyance. Perfect. So, he accesses his Google, just like that, and goes, ah yes, first he was born in the animal realms, and now he's in the hell realms. So she kind of went, Oh no, what can I do for him? And he kind of laughed sadly, she said, and said, what do you mean just for him? He said, for everybody. She's not even a Buddhist. I saw her years later. She was very moved by that, she said. But another story I heard recently blew my mind. One woman or somebody went to Geshe-la Khonchog and about her mummy, and he said, she's in the hell realms. I said, can you help him? Can you help her? Can you help her? He said, yeah. So he took her out of the hell realms. I mean, don't ask me how these lamas do it, but they've got kind of power, you know? If they've got a strong karmic connection, they can literally influence your mind at whatever level. So it's kind of hopeful, isn't it? So stick around these people, okay? So even these lamas with strong, that's what they're saying, strong connection with the person, they can help them. They know exactly where they are, and they can influence their mind. And we can understand this. We have a relationship with the lama. We know they influence our mind. There's no question. Isn't it? Don't you have that experience? Well then, why can't they influence you while you're in the lower realms? Not illogical. Completely the same, you know. When a high lama transfers someone, and they do the job, the high lama is the one who's able to get their consciousness and get it go zap at the crown. When a high lama transfers somebody's consciousness to a pure land, many special signs happen, such as rainbows in the sky or white light emitting from the person's body. I mean, who wouldn't want a person around at a time of death like that? Thank you very much. I want to book up my appointment. However, if your loved one is an accomplished meditator, actually in meditation, there's no need to do POA. They can take care of themselves. POA can also be practiced during the 49 days after death. And that's a later practice we're going to talk about. But you can do it then as well. So the three times you can do it, the person who does it themselves before they die, because they train, and then they can do it at the time of death. But that's quite advanced. You've got to be very together to do that, I'd say. The lama do it for you once you stop breathing, or a lama do it for you in the 49 days. But if you haven't got a lama, you can do it too. And this is in the book as well. This beautiful, I mean, Tama Poa that Lama Yeshe wrote. It's in the book as well. You can do it together with your friends, you know. The practice, what to do, so if it, now it's the scenarios where your loved one has died. So the ideal scenario, as I'm saying, as we're talking, is the 3-day one, which would mean you'd be at home, you know, unless you've got a lot of money and you can pay to be in a private hospital, in your own private room, you understand? One of my friends, who had her husband in a private place, and this is why, okay, well, one step at a time, okay, never mind. So anyway, there are many, all these same practices Rinpoche has mentioned, but there are certain ones he would say that are good to do in this period. So this is all listed, you know? So remember, when I say lying in the bed, in that room, perfect, like a shrine room, no pets. Keep the pets out. Especially now the breath has stopped. You should not allow cats or dogs in the room, especially cats. It is said that their hair is polluted somehow, and they're connected to spirits. Also, if a cat sits on a dead body, it's possible a spirit could follow and enter the body. And spirits are very suffering, heavy-duty beings who often one of their jobs is they can, like, you know, people, humans who get possessed. That's what it is. A spirit is coming literally living in your body. You know, you hear many stories like this. And certainly a dead body can be very vulnerable to spirits going into it and using it, you know. So keep the animals out. Be quiet. Continue to keep the environment peaceful and quiet, only the sounds of mantras and prayers. That's for the 3 days, or as many days as you do. And many people, of course, in the monasteries, for example, you know, or even other places, they bring in the monks and the nuns and they have 24 hours non-stop, all day, all night for 3 days. If you can do that, that's fantastic. But anything less than that is fine too. Rinpoche always says, he quotes Chödön Rinpoche, says you always should have light offerings. It's good to have lights. And they used to use butter lamps, of course, but we can have electric lights, you know. Also, having lights on can prevent spirits from entering the body as well. That's what the Tibetans say. Touch with holy objects. Now, if you haven't already put the holy objects on your loved one's body, now's the time to do it. Put on their heart chakra, on the crown, put holy objects, mantras, things like this. And do prayers and meditate. So here, typically, in the Gelugpa tradition, in the monasteries, one set of prayers they always now recite are called the 8 prayers to benefit the dead. So one of those is the King of Prayers. And this is often the typical one. And Rinpoche says, if you can't do all the 8, do the King of Prayers. But there's another one, which is called the prayer to be reborn in Amitabha's Pure Land. Of course, you can do it all the time. Now that I'm a fan of Amitabha's Pure Land, this is the last prayer I say to myself on my iPod. I play it as I'm going to sleep, hoping it'll kind of get me there when I go, you know, when I die. So you can do it every day, any of these prayers. And Rinpoche says, if you can't recite all eight, recite at least the King of Prayers. In commentaries, it says that this prayer contains, anyway, 10 numberless times 100,000 prayers of the bodhisattvas. God knows that. Whatever, whatever. Very, very powerful. Purification. And, of course, it's a cause of going to Amitabha's Pure Land, apparently. King of Prayers. So is the other one. Recite the Guru Puja. Do Nyungne. Do lots of practices. All these practices are mentioned. You can choose what you do, assuming you've decided on the 3 days. So, and every time it's the same thing. When the time has come to move the body. Now, that's the point. And you can do this earlier. You can do this earlier. You should check that the mind has left the body. And there's a little chapter, there's a section here with several things that show the mind has left the body. But the simplest one is, as I mentioned, the whole death process is all the energy, the physical and mental, going from the top, from the bottom. Everything comes to the heart chakra. Everything comes back to this indestructible drop at the heart. So if the mind is still there, you put your hand above here, you will feel warmth vividly. It'll be warm. That's the proof the mind is still there. Okay? It can be frozen cold, the rest of the body. But here, if it's the warmth is there, that's a good sign. Don't touch the body, but put your hand above there. The same with the animals, you know? So then, usually they seem to say that 3 days is always gone by that time. They say that. But of course it could be sooner. A violent death, it could leave immediately, you know? So, when it gets tricky, it gets when we get to the hospital, which is the next section, which I'll read to you. So the thing to do before, anyway, even if it is the 3 days, what you're going to do, this is what's recommended every time, what you're going to do is you tug very strongly here at the crown chakra, or you tap really vigorously, don't be polite, really strongly there, and that can encourage the consciousness to come from here, zapping up the central channel, to leave through the crown chakra, which means they go to a pure land. To do that is always recommended. Before you do anything else with the body, you've got to try and make the consciousness go. 3 days is probably gone, but this is where it gets tricky if you've only got a half an hour in the hospital. We'll get to that one in a second. Are you with me, people? Another thing he recommends, and this is only, mostly Tibetans do this. This is not typical in our culture. Consult an astrologer. Typically, a Tibetan would consult an astrologer immediately after the mind has left the body. Astrology can indicate what practices should be done to prevent your loved one from being born in the lower realms, or to help them to take a good rebirth, such as which statue or tanka should be made on their behalf, that if you do this or that practice, they will have a good rebirth or reborn as a monk or a nun or even a great lama. It can even predict where their good rebirth will be taken. However, it said that this usually only works for ordinary people. Astrology can't predict the future of the great holy beings, nor very evil people. You need to tell the Tibetan astrologer which of the 12 animal signs your loved one was born under, as well as the date and time they passed away, or even perhaps the hour, or whether it was in the morning or the night. It's important to be accurate. There's astrology in the West, of course, but I'm not sure if it predicts future lives. So, I don't know. Most Westerners I know don't do this, but it's there because Rinpoche said it, and it's in this particular book that he's quoting from. The practices to do if your loved one dies in hospital. So I think the first thing I want to say here is that you've got to know what your rights are in the hospital. You've got to know in advance you want to be as long as you can in that bed. You want to have as long as you can. That means you've got to know what your rights are, know what the deal is with the hospitals, know what you can and can't do. You understand? You've got to know. Goodbye. Who's that? Do I know that gentleman? Do I know you? Who are you?
We met years ago.
Oh, I'm very happy to know it. Who? What's your name?
John,
I'm happy to meet you, John. I'm glad we met years ago. Maybe I'll meet you again before we die. See you. Thank you, darling. Bye. So, you've got to have your cool about you. You've got to all done this in advance. You've got to have your wits about you. Be clear. Know what your rights are. And when your loved one stops breathing, that's when you say, excuse me, out the door. To all the kind people, the kind nurses, the kind doctors, get him out. Tell Robbie to get out of the room and mind his own business. Leave my dead body loved ones alone. Because naturally the doctors and nurses are going to do their job, aren't they? They've got a job to do, but not yet. And that's why you've got to know in advance. I mean, does anybody know, Robbie, do you have any clue? Does anybody, nurses, know how long, sometimes depending on the hospital, how long you can be there, right? Tell me.
We can leave them up to 6 to 8 hours.
You got permission.
Yes.
You're allowed to have the bed for that time.
Yeah.
Well, that's What are other people's experience?
Not in the hospital.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It has to be, doesn't it?
And if they need the bed, you may only have 30 minutes or an hour.
That's right. I understand, yeah, 30 minutes. So that's the thing, you've got to know in advance. So this is what happened. Say to them, it's okay, it's fine. So what happened in Los Angeles when Lama Yeshe passed away, the hospital were very kind, and they put Lama's body on a gurney and wheeled him to a spare room, and they let him have a room for like 8-10 hours. So maybe you can negotiate with the hospital. Tell Lama's little corner, we can be quiet. If people never ask, they won't ever know. But if you say you want that, most people don't know why you want it. It seems weird to people. But if you know that's possible, please negotiate. People are so kind, you know. And this will be so special to do. Wheel very carefully, and you put into this private place where you can then close the door and do the prayers and the practice for as long as you can. That's why if they do die in the middle of the night, don't call the nurses in. Keep it quiet and be delighted. It's quiet time, you know. That's the time you do the prayers and practices. And as much as you can. Rinpoche says, you know. When Lama Yeshe passed away at 5 o'clock in the morning, the Cedars Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, staff gave us a room to put Lama in. And we'll talk about this. It's very sweet how Rinpoche talks about this. So do your best to keep the environment peaceful and quiet. Only the sounds of prayers. Of course in hospitals this has to be difficult. You know, but do your best. That's why if you can ask for a private place for as little few hours, really wonderful. And know in advance you want to do this. So when they do stop breathing, you get people out of the way. You're in charge. Know you've got the power. You're in charge, not anybody else. So you do the usual things, the same as before. Bless the body with a text, pray, mount, do whatever prayers you can. But the very minimum Rinpoche recommends, medicine Buddha and or King of Prayers. Minimum, these ones, minimum. All the same thing, just list the prayers. And then, this is when it's really important, when you have to get the body, when the body has to be moved. So tell me, I just always be confused, what happens in a hospital? Can you please tell me what happens to a dead body, normally speaking? Tell me who knows these things. Who are the nurses around here? Okay. And if there's other experiences, tell me if there are different experiences. Go on.
Like right after they die?
Yeah, give me the scenario, what typically happens.
Well, if the family's not there, we call the family and we will try and wait within, in my experience with the hospital I worked at, about 30 minutes to an hour, we will wait and let the body there.
But not longer?
Not usually. And then, you know, we put them in the white
So what would you do with the body at that moment? After, if there's no family there, what would you do with the body? Once it stops breathing, what do you do?
We would reposition it and basically make it look comfortable and nice for the family to come in and
so clean off the vomit
one.
and close their eyes. So then what if the family doesn't come? What do you do?
Then if we know the family's not coming and they pronounce, you know,
yep,
and all our charting is
dead,
done,
yep,
then we put them in that white little zip-up bag and take them down to the morgue.
Okay. And they sit in the morgue for how long?
I'm not sure how long they stay in the morgue.
What's your experience?
Did they have...
Go on.
Very similar, depending on what, like you said, they can negotiate, and I've had that happen more than once. So, but they can sit in the morgue overnight.
So what's why are they? What, so what happens?
They're
after?
Waiting for the funeral home to come and get them.
Oh, okay.
So if it's in a small town that I've worked before,
could be straight away. You take them straight to the funeral home.
Yeah, it could go straight to the funeral home, or it could wait up to 12 hours, depending on.
So this is where I find interesting. I told you the experience I had in Santa Cruz. This is now 15, 20 years ago, when my friend Paul had a heart attack and died at home. He'd begged his wife not to call the ambulance. She was a Buddhist as well, so was the daughter, but the wife freaked out and called the ambulance. So they took him to Santa Cruz. He was in the bed. We came. We did the King of Prayers. We did the prayers. They pulled the plug on him because he wanted that. So then they very kindly zipped him up off the bed, and they agreed they'd take him immediately to the mortuary. So we went with him to the mortuary, and I think this is something you could do, you know. I mean, Rav Zabu doesn't say this because it's not his words. It's my experience. So then we negotiated with the mortuary. We sat there all day with him saying prayers. All day. Then I said, I remember I told you, they wouldn't let us do it after 4 p.m. They had to stick him in the fridge with the other dead bodies. Well, we gave him a CD of the Gyuto monks chanting, and they promised they'd play it in the fridge. But, I mean, you've got to know your rights, you know. They promised they would. We can't guarantee they did. So how marvelous. The best we could do was that they wouldn't let us have stay all night. So we came next day, they took him out, more prayers, and then finally they did their trip. So there's many things you could do. You've got to know what your rights are, and you've got to know what you want to do here, which is best for the person who's dead, you know? Yeah.
Was that at the mortuary, or was
the
that...
The mortuary.
It wasn't at the hospital?
No, straight away they wrapped him up and put him in the ambulance. The mortuary was organized, you know, because we were there. So that's a really helpful thing. And they can move the body very gently, you know. And then you're in the mortuary. It's really quiet in mortuaries, obviously. There's no dramas in mortuaries. They're not trying to keep anybody alive, you know. So it was really kind of nice for those 2 days. And even the CD of the Guto monks. Why not? They might be happy to play them. All the other dead bodies got the Guto monks as well. Lucky them. Isn't it?
I just was wondering, does anybody know how many days we can legally have a body at home? In North Carolina?
Elise, where's Elise? She's not here. She did this research in North Carolina.
What Elise said yesterday is that if a person dies at home, right. Not unattended alone, but unattended by medical personnel, someone has to sign the death certificate within 24 hours.
So even you've got 24 hours, it seems to me, to be quiet, you know?
And then... You do not. I mean, the point is if you notify a mortuary, they will have to. But you, legally, there is no requirement for you to move that body sooner than 3 days.
So the person who signs off on the death is not required
to take
to
the body.
Call a funeral home?
No.
They're not required to. And that is one of the advantages of having hospice in, because hospice, the nurse can do it, and then she will leave.
And the other thing is, did you ever get this? I asked Elise to do this research in different states, and it's quite helpful. There's quite a lot of space, actually, to do things you want. We just don't know these things. It's really quite helpful. But the more you know about it, you can let people know. It's very helpful for this town.
And may I just add one thing? There's a difference between what you can do at hospitals and what you can do
at home
in a skilled nursing facility. I think that's an important thing to know.
Give an example. What do you mean?
For example, if it is a skilled nursing facility, which is not a hospital, as long as you're paying for the room...
You can have as long as you like. Of course you can.
The body can stay.
Of course it can,
now, probably not 3 days, but at least overnight or 24 hours.
But why not if you pay for it?
What?
Why not if you pay for it?
Why not? Because then you move into health law rules in terms of whether or not they can have the body there.
Okay.
Well, at least 24 hours without disturbing it in a skilled nursing
facility. The key one here is to know what your rights are in advance, not to sit like a baby and burst into tears and have a panic attack. You know, that's the big point. Like one of my friends in Tasmania, she had a private place. Wherever she was. And she had a private place. Her husband died. So she just... Thank you very much. Goodbye. Locked the door and stayed as long as she needed. Did all the things she had to do completely peacefully, you know. The key one every time for me is to have the education. We all know that. When you're educated, you do the job properly. If you just panic, that's a disaster, you know. Go on, yeah. Yes, yes, and yes, yeah.
I just
where's the mic, please?
Here, Kim.
Oh, sorry.
Good. Thanks, Ellen.
Somebody else has their hand up. Sorry.
Go on. Go, Donna.
I just wanted to say that when my mother passed, she passed at home. I held her hand when she died. Then I waited until my brother came up from the basement. He said goodbye. I called the
rest. Before you were a Buddhist?
Yes.
Okay.
Called all the siblings. They came. Then after 6 hours, we called the hospice nurse. Mm-hmm. Then she came. But during those 6 hours, you know, I played the piano. We talked about old times. We all had.
Well, that's nice for you, but not for you. Good for your mum, though. Remember that.
Yeah.
Well, okay, we're discussing what's good for your mum here. That's not helpful to your mum. It's nice for you guys.
Well,
I'm not being rude, just letting you know.
Well, we didn't move her, is what I'm saying.
Well, that's helpful.
Yeah,
good.
We didn't move her.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad. Peaceful. That's great. Go on. What's next? Go on.
I just wanted to say that the North Carolina Cremation Society...
Oh, yeah, good.
...will do this for you. My husband and I have made our pre-arrangements, and... you know, we plan on taking care of each other this way, but if it's left to our children, then it's in our contract with the North Carolina Cremation Society that they will hold our bodies for 3 days. And
but in the fridge, though?
Yes.
See, that's no good. Fridge is no good. Not cool, but it's better than nothing.
It is.
That's better than nothing, but you can't do the deal with the mortuary where you did like what I said, have the body out all day, you do prayers with it. Just having your body for 3 days is not much help unless you're doing prayers and stuff.
Well, I mean, you have to arrange for that as well.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
But you have to be in the fridge, wouldn't you, though?
I assume it's a
fridge. Yeah, that's right, darling. That's good to know, though. That's helpful to know. Thank you. What else?
People, Venerable Rabina, when you helped me with my cat passing,
yep.
I was able to keep him at home.
Yep.
And then I pulled on his head like you told me to,
yep.
And I left the mantras on him. And
good.
By the next morning, I checked around 2 a.m. and the heat was still there.
You could feel it.
Oh yes.
Tell us about that. It's good to experience.
Yes,
I've never done it. Tell us about it.
He died approximately. He stopped breathing about 10 o'clock at night. I woke up again around 2. I could still feel the heat.
So you put it, where'd you put your hand?
On just right heart. On his right.
And you really could feel it?
Oh, yes.
That's interesting.
And
isn't
then
it?
By the time then I finally fell asleep again, and about 9 o'clock in the morning, he was cold all over. I left the mantras on him, and they said they left them on them when he was cremated.
Well done. That's exactly how it should be. Oh. That's interesting. That's a good. I've never done it, so that's experience that you
that
could
was,
feel the
heat.
So you could feel the heat.
Yes, I
that's
could.
Good
and
to
that,
know,
that
isn't
was
it?
All on your instructions. So
okay, that's
thank
how I'm
you
happy. That's great. I'm glad it works. I've never done it myself. So you could feel the heat. That's interesting. But I've noticed many nurses talk to me and they say you just know when the person's gone. Do people have experience with dead bodies? You just sort of know that?
Yeah.
People say that many times. That's probably intuitively right.
Yeah.
You feel the difference. That's interesting, isn't it, that?
Look at everything.
It's interesting, isn't it? That's very interesting. So, that's very interesting. Go on.
And just a reminder, in terms of, I'm a former palliative care chaplain,
yes.
So hospital chaplain.
Yes.
And so in terms of advocating for families, and know that the Department of Pastoral Care is your friend.
Really?
So any hospital.
This is it locally?
It is,
wow.
Locally. So
fantastic.
Any university hospital, any community hospital.
Yes.
The chaplains are here for you.
Wow, amazing.
No matter your faith tradition.
That's
so
right.
Always call the on-call chaplain.
That's fantastic.
Department of Pastoral Care.
Good.
So it's our job to make sure that we advocate for
wonderful.
The patients and family.
That's really good, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Good to know. Any other points, people? Any other points?
Anybody.
No? Okay, let's go. Running out of time here. What time are we finished?
4:30.
Oh, good, in a whole hour. Look at this. I can talk more. Okay. Okay. So then the same deal is if your loved one offers their organs. So anybody wasn't here when I talked about organs? Okay, so we'll talk about it again. It's a good point. We'll talk about it again. Okay. I'll read Rinpoche's what he says. You want a bathroom break?
Yeah.
Have a bathroom break. 5 minute bathroom break. Go on. So, okay, any questions before we carry on? A few more things to say, then we're done. Any questions? Okay, let's go. So we're up to the fridge, aren't we? If your loved one dies at home, if your loved one dies in hospital. All this is really good discussion, you know. The next one is the organs, which is very fascinating. So, Rinpoche says, some people decide to offer their organs to others. Let's sit down first. Wait for the others to come. Well, some people decide to offer their organs to others after they've died. Does this disturb the mind? Well, it seems that when the person is considered brain dead, the doctors keep the body breathing artificially, and they continue to keep the body breathing when they actually cut out the organs. I question this. Even if the brain is no longer functioning, if the person has the karma to breathe, this means they have the karma to be alive, which of course means the mind is still there. So obviously it's the sat, remember they've got the gross consciousness. That has ceased. Which means they can't feel anything. They can't see or feel. The nervous system has stopped. But the subtle consciousness is still active. And that, in this is my talking now. But we know from people, let's say, in their unconscious on the operating table, they can leave their bodies and see what's going on. Well, you can deduce that the same could be here. The subtle consciousness can still be aware of what's happening, like you're floating above your body. That's not, they don't talk like that, but that's exactly what can happen. So it's not impossible to imagine. There you are, like we said, on the operating table. And they're, like that story I mentioned in that book I read, The Undead, and they're about to get the circular saw on this woman's body, and of course, because they consider the person dead, they don't give them anesthetic. So even though Rinpoche says that I don't feel anything, it's kind of, it has to be a shocking experience that the subtle conscious is aware. I'm just saying these words, if you think about it. But the key point that Rinpoche is making, if the mind is still there, and as we discussed, if the breath has stopped, even if the breath has stopped and the brain is not functioning, some people can come back to life. So in other words, the crucial point for the Buddhist view, this view, until you are certain the mind has left the body, you cannot say the person is dead. So the number of people you read stories, people in coffins, people waking up, can you imagine the terror of waking up in a coffin, you can't open it and you're under the ground. I mean, you can only imagine the nightmare. Then you're on this operating table, like I quoted from this book I read, The Undead, this medical journalist reporting on all different problems coming out now as a result of farming organs or whatever they call it. The nurse, as this woman was having a circular saw, cut her open. The nurse reported that the heart went from 100 beats to 200 beats a minute. And as the author said, I wonder what a dead body's heart is doing, doubling its pace. So it's kind of interesting. It is interesting, you know. Well, certainly until you know the mind has gone, and the fact is, if the person is breathing, there has to be a must of the deduction. There has to be the mind there. It's impossible for a dead body to breathe, even artificially. And of course you'd feel there'd be warmth there, you know, so clear. So this is just a dilemma. So Rinpoche says they won't feel it, but you don't know the person's dead until the mind is left, because people can come back to life. And it's not as if it's that uncommon, just that people don't like to hear about it, so they don't report these stories. You know, they just think it sounds like voodoos or something, or, you know, zombies and things. But it also says that still I think because the person is dying with the thought of benefiting others. Assuming they did die, this is what Rinpoche doesn't say that, but you think about it. You know? Then it will be marvelous for the person. It's virtuous karma. There's no doubt that you offered your organs. It's like offering your body to others is an extraordinary virtuous thing to do. Isn't it? But as I mentioned, another lama pointed out, and I couldn't put it in the book because it's not Rinpoche's, that, you know, that maybe at the time of death they freak out. That doesn't mean they're going to still be virtuous. Maybe they offered their organs 20 years ago and they forgot. Do you understand? So it's an interesting point. So anyway, the way it says in here, you know, I said in the book, ask the hospital to allow you as much time as possible with the body of your loved one. Even an hour. You know, and sort of, you can't do this one on them because they're still breathing. The machine, that's what was Tim, he was breathing, right? And you do the prayers, best you can. You can't get the conscious to leave. This is why, but I'm wondering if a great yogi did, they could make it leave. Like, even though they're living, they could still do it, but obviously you can't. You do all the prayers you possibly can, put mantras on their body, all of this business, you know, and then pray and hope the mind is not in the body, or the mind, or they won't have a difficult experience while they're being sawed up and all their organs are ripped out, you know. God Almighty. And then do the usual things, touch the body with all texts, mantras, same practices, same. But the only one is you wouldn't do this one, because the mind is still there. But, you know, we put it in the book, when the time has come to receive the body. So what happened? So that, not in your, in Tim's case, you didn't receive the body. But if you receive the body, you can still do the business of doing the mind one. You never know, you know. And you'd then, you know, tug at the crown, all that. And then after or each of these situations, you'd then prepare the body for cremation, wouldn't you? And the last one is if you die, so the next one is if your loved one dies suddenly. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. It just means you've got, is that a question? No. Yes, what's the question now? A microphone, please.
So, this is a question for you.
Yeah.
So, I'm asking your opinion.
Okay.
So, there's virtue in organ donation, and then there's the problem of how long... what do you suggest? Organ donation, no organ donation? Because it's a dilemma for me, personally.
I understand that. You see, I thought about it, you know, and I thought, okay, I think, yes, it'd be really good to use my body to help people. So obviously, it sounds, I'm not trying to be cynical in any way, it is just incredibly noble if somebody can live from Tim Powell's organs, if somebody can live from that, you know? No, there's no question to give somebody life. But it seems to me, The fact that you can't keep another person alive doesn't mean like an evil person. It's not as if that's the greatest gift you can give somebody, because death is natural. So for me, I think, well, why not give my body to the young doctors to cut up and use every bit of me to learn how to be a better doctor? I find that's just as virtuous. Hmm. Just because, when it's, and I'm not trying to be cynical about all this industry, which it is, but this author was quite cynical about it. All they're the elitist doctors of the time, they're the ones that charge the biggest prices, there's a lot of political and manipulating, and then because of all this, the dilemma, and I forget in this book that I read, if you'd like to take the book that I'm talking about, called The Undead, by Nick Terracey. It's a very interesting book that brings up all the different problems now with this. And he even said one time, the undead called Nick, his name is Dick or Nick Terracey, T-E-R-E-S-I, is an American medical journalist. It's a fascinating book. He's pointing out all the problems now and the dilemmas that are created because people coming back to life, people having out-of-body experiences, people, you know, changing them. I mean, all kinds of things. And just the whole the politics of it all, making it quite complicated, you know? So I think, my mind, you know, it's not the holiest thing to do, to give a person, to keep another person alive. That's great. But also you can help people in other ways, you know. It's not the end of the world. So I've decided I'm not going to give my organ. What old person's organs anyway? I wouldn't know. No big deal, you know. Yeah.
Just one more thing I'd like.
Huh? So it was before. So Rinpoche, when he heard about Tim, the boy who died here, and he was pronounced dead at midday, the nuns were with him, and then they took him, but all by midnight, all his organs gone. And all Rinpoche said was, couldn't they have left him longer? You know? And that's the point of the Buddhist one, to help the consciousness, to get prayers done, to give them some space, so hopefully for it to leave in an appropriate way, you know. For the sake of the dead person. Of course, that does not exist. And this man's book wouldn't be about that, because it's about the living. So even one of the guys, this author said, he said, I really do wish they would spend as much money and care and time on keeping me alive, keeping me healing, keeping me well when I'm dying, as they do on the person whose organs they want. Do you understand what I'm saying? The care and money that's spent on keeping people alive, the ones whose organs they want, is way superior to ordinary care. So that's you'd have to say that's cynical. That's outrageous. Unbelievable. They keep bodies for so long sometimes, all kind of warm and toasty, like alive, you know, because they want the organs. And there's, I don't know, it's an interesting topic. I think and that book I found so interesting to read. All I know is one woman, and I forget all the reasons now, I'm sorry, one woman whose baby's organs had been used to give life to other babies. She was so moved by all that, she started working for one of these organ something or others volunteer organizations. She got so upset with all the politics that she stopped. She didn't want to do it anymore. So I can't say too much because I don't remember the facts, you know, but it's a very interesting book. But the key point, and his is not the Buddhist reason. His is just the politics of it all, and the you know, and like this young Italian man, his organs were out ready on the table to go. They were frantic to manipulate the parents to give the decision, and they were furious because they decided, no, you can't have his organs. They had to sew them back in, almost like that, you know, that kind of stuff. That's the stuff that she goes on about. But the Buddhist one is bottom line: how is it if it hinders the experience of the person who's dying? And all I know is that 100 beats an hour to 200. That's a pretty shocking. That's a pretty outrageous thing. Isn't it? One nurse was shocked. So there's just these things to think about. But the bottom line is as to whether it's going to hinder your next birth. That's the bottom line for the Buddhist. Do you understand? Go. Yeah. You're going to say something. Where's the mic?
He passed.
Go on, talk to me. What's your point, darling? Yeah.
I mean, from a personal standpoint, if you know, like, you have, like, cancer or diabetes or you've abused drugs for a long time and before you, and isn't that kind of not virtuous to donate your organs since you know that they could be, they won't take them?
They
won't take them. Oh, okay.
No, of course, listen, honey.
I didn't know that.
Listen. Of course it's virtuous.
No, I said no.
But listen, the whole point here, can you not see, okay, what's the essential point I'm thinking, do you think?
No, I just didn't know about...
Well, why would they want an old drug dealer's liver for? Thank you.
No, I didn't mean it like that, but, like, never mind.
Darling, of course it's virtuous, but that's not the only virtuous thing you can do. You've got to change your mind and purify and die well with virtue on your mind. This is just an extra little baby thing. But it's made huge at the moment in this big industry, you know. Do you understand? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Well, I do have a memory of many, many years ago.
Yes.
I was visiting Geshe Sopa.
You're what?
Visiting Geshe Sopa.
Yes, Geshe Sopa, yes.
In his house.
In Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Yes.
And I happened to know his driver's license was sitting there, and he had at that time checked off the organ.
To give his organs, yes.
Part.
Yes, amazing, yes.
Yeah. No, you know, he got to be 89.
But if you're Geshe Sopa and you're a holy being and you're a yogi and you can do exactly what you like and you can meditate for days on end while you're dead and then leave when you feel like it, that's marvelous. Nothing wrong with that. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine having Geshe Sopa start. That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
Probably a lot of power even there.
That's exactly right. If you've got control, then go for it.
Yeah.
Take their toes and their everything else.
Uh-huh. You know, after you get to a certain, like, our age, right, they don't even want you.
No, that's exactly right. That's right. That's right. Exactly. 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 So go on. Yes, sweetheart. Go.
So the story of Geshe Sopa's death, Paul was there.
Yes.
When he was dying or dead. And it was unbelievable to me what Paul described, that Geshe Sopa was sitting up meditating.
Yes.
For 5 days after he had
there
stopped
you go.
Breathing.
That's it.
And did not decompose.
That's exactly right.
But I saw photographs of him, and it was very, very weird.
Very special. That's wonderful. I'm going to read a little bit from here, from Rinpoche, talking about these things. This is what gives great encouragement, isn't it? These great yogis. And they say that even if they meditate for days and weeks, their bodies won't decompose, because as long as the subtle consciousness is there. I remember reading one yogi, one of Rinpoche's gurus, I'll read about this, who passed away in Dharamsala and meditated for several days. I heard that people saw photos on the day he was meditating like this, and on the day he died, and there he was, his body looking normal, even 3 days later, because even though the mind is still there, the gross mind has ceased, so the body kind of shrivels. And by the third day, his little head was sort of poking up, you know. You could tell the difference, the distinct difference in the body. But it never decomposes because the mind is there. That's the point, you know. So there's interesting stuff in here from Michelle about these kind of things. I'll read from you. I'll read in a minute. So then basically the one of the organs, you just got to, you know, well, we've talked about it. Okay, but the same prayers, do as much as you can. And I would suggest very strongly, Rinpoche doesn't say this, but it really would make sense. And this is what you guys were doing here. That when during the period that Tim was having his organs cut out, you have the lamas on the case doing pujas, please. Helping the mind. You know, that's really, I'd say that's absolute. Definite, and have that in your written will or whatever you want. When you're cutting my organs out, I want the pujas done for me right there, you know. That's going to absolutely help you for sure. That was happening for Tim, you know. So the last one is if your loved one has high realizations and is meditating at the time of your death. Okay, so as I discussed in chapter 10, and I'll tell you in a minute, those with high tantric realizations can remain in meditation in the clear light, conjoined with emptiness for as long as they wish. 1 hour, 3 days, many months. Some meditators stay in the clear light meditation in their hermitage for years. If your loved one is in meditation, you must not disturb them. The face of the meditator is very radiant. That's what you're saying about Geshe Sopa. Peaceful, even blissful. They look magnificent, totally different from an ordinary dying person. Sometimes there even seems to be light at the tip of their nose. While they're in meditation, even though the breath has stopped, there will be no smell or decay. They smell the same as when they were alive. Or, as I mentioned earlier, there could even be a sweet smell. When Lama Yeshe passed away, and he was in the hospital all day in Sudha Sinai. They drove him up to Vajrapani, and then for another 5 days he was there. And people who, in and out of where he was, they said it was really smelt very sweet. They said that. Because he was meditating the whole time. I'll read about this. Obviously if your loved one's in meditation, you wouldn't call an astrologer, because that's to help the mind leave. That's to work out. Anyway, you just wouldn't do that. Never mind. So, however, says that for somebody who is in meditation, you should not consult an astrologer about when to move the body until their meditation is over. Otherwise, there's the risk that the astrologer might recommend to move the body while the mind is still there. However, if the meditation is not over, but for various reasons, such as the country's laws, you have no choice but to move the body, you need to request the meditator to end their meditation. While you are requesting them, you can offer music with cymbals, bell, damaru, and so forth, as Song Rinpoche advised me when Lama Yeshe was in meditation. Or you could recite the Guhya Samaja root text. More simply, you could put incense very close to their nose of the meditator, and it's very auspicious to recite the prayers they be reborn in a pure land. In the case of some holy beings, such as Ling Rinpoche, His Holiness's root guru, and one of Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa's gurus, but also of Lama Yeshe, even though their bodies were moved several times, their meditation did not cease and they were not disturbed. As I mentioned before in the book earlier, Ling Rinpoche meditated for 13 days after the breath had stopped. So as I mentioned again in chapter 21, another chapter, my numbers, what wisdoms, Lama Yeshe passed away at the Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, a wonderful hospital. Before Lama passed away, the nurses were watching intently throughout the night. The moment Lama's heart stopped, people rushed in with a defibrillator and wanted to get it started again. It was all very hectic in the room. I had checked with Song Rinpoche, this is one of their lamas who came over from Switzerland, you know, especially, who earlier had come to be with Lama but now was back in Switzerland, and he said to do everything possible to save Lama. The defibrillator is very strong. It pulls the body up violently. Lama opened his eyes for a moment, then his body fell back down. The doctor then said there was no hope. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was on Tibetan New Year's Day, so it's very auspicious, you know, dawn. This was my first time dealing with someone passing away in the West. I had no experience. Apparently, they usually take the body to the mortuary where they prepare it. But I didn't think we needed to do that. That's for ordinary people, not for those who are in meditation state like Lama. Anyway, Lama remained in meditation in a private room throughout the day. And this is what they asked the hospital, and they were very kind, and they gave them the room. By the late afternoon, we couldn't stay for any longer, so I asked Rinpoche, Song Rinpoche, what should be done to release Lama from his meditation. As I mentioned, Rinpoche advised me to play instruments, so I made 3 prostrations, rang a bell, and requested Lama to stop. I also recited the prayer to be reborn in a pure land from the Vajrayani practice, and I touched Lama's crown. Of course, Lama didn't need all of this, as he had already achieved the clear light and illusory body, all the high realizations. Apparently, there was a candle, and one of the students present in the room said that he saw a second flame leap up from the candle. I didn't see it. They put Lama's holy body in a box, packed in ice, and took it to a mortuary. The next day, one of the students drove it the 350 miles north to Lama's center, Vajrapani Institute, very slowly. When they were preparing Lama's body for the fire puja, what they do is for these holy beings, a couple of hundred of us all came to Vajrapani from all over the world. And Lama's body was in a coffin in the Gompa, in the room next to the Gompa. And then we had Song Rinpoche come, and we did 3 or 4 days of many, many, many prayers and pujas all the time, you know. Song Rinpoche gave teachings, Lama Zopa gave teachings. And then the 4th or 5th day, they prepared Lama's body for a fire puja, many hours of a fire puja. I'll explain. When they were preparing Lama's body for the fire puja, okay, let me read from the funerals. It says it about in there. Where's the funeral? How to prepare, okay, that's not that one. Funeral. Okay, so I just want, because there's something more about Lama Yeshe there. Okay. Lama Yeshe's... Okay. I'm sorry, it's going back and forth. I invited Song Rinpoche. The ceremony we had for Lama was a Yamantaka offering burning puja, fire puja. Students came from everywhere. Geshe Sopa came from Wisconsin, and Geshe Tinle, one of Lama Yeshe's brothers, came from Australia. I had invited Song Rinpoche to come again from Switzerland. Before the burning puja, we did many days of practices, including the Haruka body mandala self-initiation, Vajrayogini, Guru puja, and we all offered the Bodhisattva Sog, written by Lama, with prostrations to the 35 Buddhas. We did these practices not for Lama's sake, but for our own. Finally, we were ready to offer Lama's holy body to the fire. A special cremation stupa was built according to Song Rinpoche's design. It's like they built up the top of the hill at Vajrapani, square structure about that high, small square with bricks painted white, with 4 holes, 4 little doorways, all 4, put lots of wood and things in the fireplace. Then they dressed Lama's body very specially. dressed in the costume of self-initiation, put upright in a chair, tied securely, and then carried up to the site and placed in the stupa. And then what they all did was then they build this cone-shaped top part that goes up like this with a piece of the top hole for the smoke to come out and holes around the side, you know, for the smoke to come. But the bottom part was where they fed, oh no, they put things in, blessed things, all the way through, put all these many things into the fire puja. So then we were finally ready to offer us, okay. Rinpoche himself did a lot of the work with his own hands, putting in the bricks, putting the firewood around Nama's holy body, and then helping people build up the top part. Everything went so well. Okay, now back to the other bit. Sorry. Coming. Okay. When they were preparing Nama's holy body for the fire puja, this is like 5 days at least, 6 days maybe after Lama passed away, I think. Lozang, who'd been one of the monks from the first Gelug monastery in Bodhinath Stupa in Nepal, and who was familiar with the rituals, reported to Song Rinpoche that even though the body had been lying in the coffin for many days, Lama's limbs were still flexible, and that it was only when they were preparing Lama's body that the white body chitta came out. So another sign, this is the traditional one, as mentioned here in another section, of the mind having left the body, is that the red and the white drops at the heart. When they split open and the subtle consciousness leaves there, the red one, or the white one, I forget which is which now, for men and women it's different. One goes up and comes out the here, and one goes down and comes out the sex organ. So if you see this subtle liquid energy, and sometimes it's a bit difficult if there's other messy stuff there, but this is a sign that the mind has left the body. The white bodhicitta came out. In other words, it seems that Lama had been in meditation state for at least 5 days, even though the body had been moved many times, from the hospital to the mortuary, the long drive from Los Angeles to Boulder Creek, and then preparing it for the fire puja. Song Rinpoche was very surprised. The body of a meditator will start to smell when the meditation is finished, in other words, when the mind leaves, just like the bodies of ordinary people. On the other hand, no matter how long the meditator's mind remains in the body, 7 days, months, or even years, they will not smell. The red and white drops coming out of the body, as with ordinary people, is also a sign, like we said before. But both drops don't necessarily come out, such as with Lama himself, as well as in the case of Genjumpa Wangdu, a friend of Lama's who passed away in Dharamsala. Geshe Jumpa Wangdu was one of my teachers, from whom I had received the oral transmission of the practice called Chulen, also known as taking the essence. Yogis in isolated places make pills from the essence of flowers and minerals and can live on these for long periods of time. They don't need any food, which means they have more time for meditation. Anyway, after bringing Lama's relics to Switzerland for blessing by Song Rinpoche, although of course Lama didn't need that, I went to Dharamsala for teachings from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The day after the teachings had finished, there was a long live puja for His Holiness, but I couldn't attend because Genjumpa Wangdu passed away early that morning after being in meditation for 3 days. One of the tantric monks and I checked to see if the bodhicitta had come out. It seemed that the white bodhicitta had, but not the red. Another sign that the mind has left the body of the meditator, whether they're sitting up or lying down, is that the head moves. Also, usually the colour of their face changes, becoming dark. But Genjumpa Wangdu's face still looked very bright, exactly the same as when he was alive, no change. When his body was taken to the place behind Tushita Retreat Center to be offered to the fire, one of his disciples was very worried that Geshe-la was still alive. He requested Kirti Senchab Rinpoche to come and say prayers and to check. Rinpoche simply looked at Geshe-la's face and he could tell immediately that his meditation was over. Also, it seems that Genjumpa Wangdu had chosen to pass away on the very day of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's long life puja so that His Holiness could live a long life. In other words, he sacrificed his own life for His Holiness. You hear stories like that. I don't quite know how it works. Okay. So now, the practices to do after the mind has left the body. So there's the ones to do the weeks and months before, the hours before, at the time the breath stops, during the time the mind is still in the body, and then once the mind has left the body. That's now. Okay. Many things he talks about. How to prepare your loved one's body for cremation or burial. So one of them is to sprinkle blessed seeds, etc. So get some sesame seeds, mustard seeds, water, perfume, talcum powder, or something similar. Recite the Namgyelma mantra 21 times, or any mantra you like, and then blow on this stuff, because you bless your breath. So usually I keep a big bag of mustard, a big packet of mustard seeds or baby powder close by. Every day, after I have chanted thousands of various mantras, I blow on the powder or seeds to bless them. I use them whenever I see dead insects or animals, or for people who have died. You could also do this, and you could send the blessed seeds to other people for them to use when people die. And this is really helpful. You have it in your car, you stop by the dead kangaroo. Oh, wrong country. A dead deer. You hop out and you sprinkle on the dead deer. And Rinpoche says this will bless them. He's really into things like this, you know. But somehow you feel like, even if you also say mantra in their ear, don't just say mantra driving by. Bless the body. This can help them, you know. If you've not already put written mantras on the body of your loved one, it's especially good to do so now to prepare for the cremation or the burial. You could use the 11 mantras that I wrote out. This is in the little liberation box. It's also in the wisdom book, printed. Or use the Namgyal mantra, whatever you like, you know, many mantras. You can put the sheets of mantras, you can print lots of them, on any part of the body so that the words are touching the skin, or even rub the body with them. Or you can put rolls of mantras on the body, on the head. Or you can wrap mantras around the body, the chest, for example. As Kirti Sensei Rinpoche explained that they do in AMDO, they use Mitugpa mantras. And they leave the mantras there when the body is buried or cremated. So if the body's to be buried, make sure you keep some hair or nails, a little bit of each, to be blessed in the Jungwa ceremony. Also, you can have ashes, you know. So now the funeral service, they don't have funeral services the way we say, but they're like, you know, it's obvious. You'd have flowers, you'd make special offerings, you'd do medicine Buddha, you'd do the King of Prayers, you'd all give talks, that kind of business, you know. Do what you like. How to bless your loved ones' ashes and include them in holy objects. This is Rinpoche really loves this practice. It's called Jungwa. This is even, like I said, you've got ashes 20 years old. As soon as the funeral service is possible, over, you should organize a Jungwa practice during which the Buddha's wisdom is invoked into the remains. As I mentioned, you need only a small amount of the ashes or bones, hair or nails, thus purifying and blessing them. Keeping the ashes of your loved one that haven't been blessed Keeping the ashes of your loved one that haven't been blessed has no benefit for the dead or the living. Whereas, as Kirti Sensei Rinpoche says, now that the ashes are purified and blessed with Jungwa, and this practice is in the book as well, in Wisdom, they are actual relics or holy objects. Even if the person died with non-virtuous thoughts, which usually means it's definite to be born in the lower realms and that in the intermediate stage, relying on methods such as Jungwa can help them change direction and receive a human body instead, or even go to the Pure Lands. They're on their way to the lower realms, but because of the power of the Vajrayana, the power of the Buddha's words, and the power of the concentration of the Lama or the person who does the practice, suddenly the person changes their direction. Then you can dedicate all the merits created by doing the blessing to your loved ones, praying that their negative karma is purified and that they receive a perfect human rebirth, etc., etc. So who can do the practice? The practice of Jungwa is usually performed by qualified lamas. You can ask the lama at your nearest Tibetan Buddhist center, or to perform the ceremony, you can ask the monks or nuns to do it. If you can't get any of them to do it, you can do it yourself, as I said, it's in the book, with your friends. You just read it. It's very long, complicated, but it's in English. You just read it with faith, you know. Originally, Jungwa was done in conjunction with Buddha Kunrig, who, as mentioned in chapter 27, is known as the king of deities, blah, blah, blah. Within Jungwa, also there's Poa. So what you can do, this is really beneficial, is you can make tatsas or statues or stupas using the blessed ashes. This makes people very happy, you know. You bless the ashes. I mean, and then you put them, and you mix it with plaster, and you make these little tatsas, these images of the Buddha, or you put them in stupas. So I'll just read Rinpoche. Now you can do even more to benefit your loved one. Having blessed the ashes with Jungwa, you can include them in holy objects such as tatsas, stupas, or statues, which brings so much benefit to your loved one and to you. You yourself can make or sponsor the making of these holy objects. Some people say that you shouldn't put ordinary people's ashes in holy objects, but as discussed in this practice, by doing the practice of Jhanwa, the wisdom of the Buddha has been invoked into them, thus purifying and blessing them. Including the blessed ashes in satsars and other holy objects creates inconceivable merit for your loved one, but it's also for you. Normally you would offer flowers or lights to your loved one at the cemetery, but this doesn't accumulate any merit. It's not even a virtuous action. But now, because you are offering to the holy object, you create huge amounts of merit. You can decide which Buddha to use, medicine Buddha, Amitabha, whatever you like. Alternatively, you could request Dharma centers to make the holy objects for you. There are FPMT centers set up for this purpose in Australia, India, New Zealand, and the United States, when the holy objects can be made and kept in memorial shrines, like Land of Medicine Buddha. Do this. You kind of offer for a little slot, they make a stupa, and instead of going to the cemetery, you go there, you know? Which is sort of, people feel very happy about this. In Australia, a couple of places, in New Zealand, they do this. In America, here, you don't do this, do you? Maybe you could one day. So, another thing you can do, if you want, instead of making the satsang, you can do both. You can throw some of the blessed ashes into the wind from a high mountain or into the sea or lake or river. All the sentient beings touched by the ashes in the air or by the water are purified of their obscurations and negative karma. I remember a friend of mine in Western Australia, her son died, like 40, you know, and then he had a wife and kids. So, of course, the grief was just incredible. And so the wife, the mother told me, didn't know what to do with the ashes, but she couldn't bear to do anything with it. She just had them on the wind, you know, on the mantelpiece. So the mother felt very happy that you could do this, because then suddenly you make the satsars, and the child gets one, the mummy gets one, the daddy gets one, everybody gets one, and there's a little precious little image of a Buddha instead of this weird can of ashes, and your boy is in that. It sort of feels very light, you know. It feels releasing somehow. It makes people happy. Do you understand? So it's a can of ashes, a stupa. It's beautiful. It's a nice thing to look at. And you feel it makes you good to know it's blessed. Do you understand? Even if not Buddhists, they like this. Then finally, there's the practices to do during the last 49 days. And this is what they say, that the traditional 49 days is because that's how long the consciousness could spend in the intermediate state. Even if they don't spend time in the intermediate state, it's still beneficial to do it. It's just a tradition. So then, of course, the best time is to do practice of day and night. You can do once a week. You can do special. And he lists all these endless practices, similar as before, you know, but you can choose. So he says there are four possibilities of what can happen to the mind after it leaves the body. Just summarizing what we've talked about. The karma that was activated at the time of death was virtuous, and the mind is still in the intermediate state. You can pray that your loved one is born in the pure lands where they can achieve the enlightenment, or receive a perfect human body where they can meet a perfectly qualified Mahayana guru and the Mahayana teachings and then achieve enlightenment. All the prayers you could do, you could dedicate to that. The second scenario, the karma that was activated at the time of death was virtuous, and the mind has already taken rebirth in the human realm or in the pure lands. In this case, it's still beneficial to do prayers and practices. Dedicate the merit to that person. And remember, the benefit of these practices for ourselves as well. There's no question, you know. The third scenario, the karma that was activated at the time of death was non-virtuous, and the mind is still in the intermediate state. This means the person will be born in the lower realms. But it's possible that prayers and practices can help the mind change direction and instead receive a human body or even a pure land, as I mentioned earlier. So it's so hopeful, isn't it? Of course, we don't know these things, so in case any of these things. And the fourth one, the karma that was activated at the time of death was non-virtuous, and the mind has already taken birth in the lower realms. Again, in this case, it's even possible to liberate a person from the lower realms, as I discuss in relation to Buddha Kunrig. So Rinpoche is full of optimism, you know. Yeah. Then all the practices, lots of practice you can do. The Medicine Buddha, King of Prayers, the Eight Prayers, offer sua. This is something to do. It's very sweet. I'll read this, very sweet. After they die, all beings except those of the formless realm have to go through the intermediate state. Because their body is subtle, because in the intermediate state there's a subtle, what they call a subtle body, the subtle physical energy, and like in a dream. That's why you can flip from pillar to post in a dream, because you haven't got a gross body, but you've got kind of bodies like made of air, you know. So in the intermediate state it's the same. You've got this kind of subtle body. But because their body's subtle, their only food is smells, and often they're referred to, these, and there's types of beings like this, as well as intermediate state beings, they're called smell eaters. So it is excellent to make the offering of the smell of food to them with a practice called sur, S-U-R. The Tibetan word sur refers to the smell of roasted barley flour. Chodron Rinpoche advised that the practice can be done in the morning, afternoon, whatever. So this practice has many benefits. It pacifies obstacles. It is an offering to the Guru, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. It's a practice of charity to all the six realms beings, blah, blah, blah. By doing it, you collect so much merit. So there's a story, this is a very sweet story, from Reba Rinpoche about someone imprisoned in Tibet for many years. They were given very small amounts of food, a dish called teen momo, but they didn't receive actual momo, only small pieces of flour in thin soup that was basically water. Because the prisoners were unbelievably hungry, when they went outside their rooms, they would search for bones in the fields, which they would then chew. Even this gave them some such strength and changed their bodies, Rinpoche said. They would also poke around with a stick in the feces of the Chinese staff, looking for undigested beans, which they would eat. The Chinese staff kitchen was nearby, so the starving Tibetan prisoners would smell the frying food. This Tibetan person said the smell would help him so much. Isn't that incredible? So it would sustain him. When he was released, he decided he would offer sur every day to the spirits, the smell eaters, because of his experience of hunger and how the smell of food helped him. That's very sweet, isn't it? And all the practices, all these things you can do, the things he's mentioned, he lists them all, okay, list, 49 days. Offering, especially things you could do retreats, you could make offerings, you could offer money on behalf of your loved one. You could offer to all kinds of projects, it says it here. You could sponsor Dharma activities, you could publish books for your loved one, lots of things you can do on behalf of your loved one to help them create merit. And you could have holy objects made on behalf of your loved one. Apart from the tsatsas, you'd have statues and stupas dedicated to your loved ones. That's very common. People do that. And often Rinpoche would recommend that for certain people, you know. And that's the end. Okay. Then the rest of the book's the practices. So any questions before I run out of my voice completely? Huh? That'll do, won't it? Enough food for thought, I would suggest. Yes? 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 What, darling? Microphone, please. Yes, sweetheart.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on something.
Yes.
That many people don't realize that bodies do not have to be embalmed.
That has to be what, darling?
Embalmed. The body doesn't have to be processed with chemicals after your loved one dies.
Who's embalming you? Who's talking about? What's
so
embalmed?
If a body goes to a mortuary center or a funeral home, generally it's a common practice to replace the fluids in the body with embalming fluids that are preservatives.
I see.
But many families don't realize that does not need to happen. And
really?
Usually, unless the body's transported across state lines or across counties, you don't have to do that.
So why would they embalm? I don't understand.
Back when they bury funerals. Generally, at funerals, what it does is it preserves the body somewhat. It softens the tissues to make them seem more lifelike.
I see. Okay, I get it. I see. That's good to know, isn't it? Thank you so much. That's very helpful. Very helpful. So what else, people? Any comments? Any questions? No? Okay, we'll just finish it. I just think, again, get the essence of this. As Rinpoche says, the main time you can help your loved one, when they need you most, is in the period before death. Getting close to the time of death. At the time of death. After the time of death. And all these things. That whole period. That's when they need you most. Because remember, if we think of the 12 links, at the time of your past birth, all the karmic seeds are triggered that will produce your next life. So then the second you start that next life, you're now living out those karmic seeds. You've planted seeds. And the point about karma is that most seeds, that 99% of the karmic seeds you sow in this life won't ripen in this life. It's something you've got to really understand. You're not producing this. This life is the fruit of past seeds. You're living out those seeds. And everything you sow now will be the future. will be the future. It's only some seeds that are very powerful actions, such as killing your mother or doing very powerful virtuous actions, that could ripen in this life. So this life is just the finishing of the seeds you already planted. So we've got to use this life to sow more seeds to produce the next life. We don't, it really takes time to get used to that, you know, because we're so caught up in the bubble of me now. So remembering that, then at the end of your life, there's nothing left to do except get them ready for the next life. And even that's why now we should be thinking and preparing for our next life. So I just kind of think of it. You know, I've got all this schedule. I go here and go there. So I've just added Amitabha's Pure Land onto the end of my schedule. I'm going to Melbourne, Sydney, London, San Francisco, Raleigh, Amitabha's Buddha's Land, you know. Whenever that'll pop in, I'm not sure. So I have to book, you know, include it in my round the world tickets. So suddenly, for the first time in my life, I'm doing this now. I'm thinking, oh, I've got to prepare for Amitabha's Pure Land. I never thought this before. And somehow doing this book helped me get that. And it suddenly feels normal. Okay, get ready for Amitabha's Pure Land. But of course I have to practice virtue now, be a good person, keep my vows, keep my commitments, try not to shout at too many people, be a nice person, and not be scared of death when it comes. And pray that it's a good scenario, and get grasp at Amitabha's Pure Land. Then I figure if I miss the boat to Amitabha's Pure Land, I'll go to get a human birth, next best. Good enough. That's my policy, okay? Are we communicating?
Yeah.
There's no harm. We can still be perky and alive and young and fresh and 20 with a life full ahead of us, but you've still got death ahead of you. And you don't know which will come first, so why not plug it in into our schedules? It kind of makes sense, you know. Do you understand? And then we cut the fear. Cut the fear, you know. Yes, sweetheart. Microphone, please.
I have a question because
Yes, darling.
Actually, two questions about animals and people.
A little bit louder.
I had two questions about animals, cats and dogs in Nepal, which I was lucky enough to track for 6 weeks.
Yes.
And then the question that I thought somehow that when you're doing the right things during your life and you're a good person, that you cannot go lower after you die, you know, in the lower level.
You have thought that, you said.
That's what I thought.
But as you can hear from this, this is not the Buddha's view. You understand
right.
that, don't you?
Right. Yes. Right. It's very interesting.
Yes.
The second question, according to when I was in Nepal, I was in shock.
Yeah.
That they just don't respect cats.
What do you mean, don't respect cats?
Cats are thin. They're not really around people. But they believe, Nepalese, Buddhists.
They believe what?
That dogs will help them to proceed in a, you know, help a soul to go to heaven.
I'm so really lost. I'm so sorry. I really want to understand you. I don't quite follow what you're saying. Please forgive me.
Well, I'm interested because in Nepal, a lot of people are Buddhists.
Yes, so, they're Buddhists. So then what you're saying they think?
So I was curious about the animals. Since
I know, I heard that part. So tell me what these people think.
They think that
are they
dogs,
the Buddhists or the Hindus? Which one? You've got to distinguish.
No, Buddhists. They are Buddhists.
So these are the Buddhists that you met, what, the Sherpas or something?
Some of them are Sherpas.
So tell me what they think precisely. What did you say?
Well, I've seen dogs running around everywhere, so I asked them about that, and also they have...
So what do you mean ask them about dogs running around? What do you mean ask them what?
Because they celebrate dogs.
Who celebrate? What do you mean they celebrate dogs?
The people.
Darling?
People in Kathmandu. And
I'm sorry, I've been there for 40 years and I don't know what you're talking about. I've never noticed people celebrate dogs. They're mean to dogs. So I can't get what you're saying. I'm trying to argue with you.
They have festivals when they put those beautiful marks on dogs.
That's the Hindus, darling.
But what about cats?
But what about, don't ask me, ask them. Sweetheart, I've got no idea. It's just, this is called culture. This is not religion, this is culture. People have different cultures. Some people adore cats. You know, some people love dogs. Filipinos eat dogs. Everybody's got different culture. I don't think it's got anything to do with Buddhist teachings. I mean, I've never thought about it. So, I mean, often Nepal, you know, in the West,
right,
we
right.
adore our cats and dogs. Kick
well,
my...
That's what I was shocked in Nepal, that they offering the bulls, but just about on the streets, you know, and then these dogs and cats, and so many different things going on, but somehow they all accept that.
Well, darling, why are you surprised by different cultures? What are you so shocked about?
Because it was my first country in being in Asia.
But so what? So you're shocked at some culture? I mean, listen to me, you're used to, what are you used to? What are you used to? What's your culture from? What country are you from?
We're very Catholic. I'm from Poland.
Okay, they're in Poland. You like cats and dogs?
Yes.
Well, okay, then, so in Australia too, and in America. But the thing is, we don't see the difference. But what that's called attachment. We completely revere our cats and dogs. We have insurance policies and give them bloody psychiatrists and feed them the best food in the world and say that, oh, I much prefer animals to humans. That's disgusting. That's not virtue. That's attachment, baby.
So where is
that's
the
not
balance?
Virtue.
Yeah, I'm asking, where is the balance?
I have no idea where the balance is. You're going to study more teaching and come to your own answer. I can't possibly answer your question. That's up to each. Every culture is different.
But
I mean,
we should respect life and we should respect
others. Well, best to say I should respect life. Don't give lectures to other people. You should respect life. Well done. And if you want to help other people respect life, you give good example to them. So if you think the Nepalese need some educating, go there and educate them. I don't know what you're telling. Or even why you're asking this, darling. I can't have any opinion about this.
Well, I didn't know that that's not Buddhism.
Of course, it's not Buddhist. How appalling! You think it's Buddhist to be mean to animals? You look at Lama Zopa. He's unbelievable. He will save rats. He will save cockroaches. He will save fleas. He's unbelievable. So Buddhists just love all sentient beings. But just because a bunch of people, some of whom are Buddhists, doesn't mean they're perfect. That's culture. It's culture, darling. Because in the West, you know what we do is we kill all the poor dogs and cats. But you don't see that because they don't make a mess of the streets. Yeah. We think we're so cute and nice. They don't kill them, maybe. We kill them all. Slaughter them. Poor veterinarians spend all their time killing animals now because it's inconvenient to us. Well, what's more virtuous? I mean, that's appalling. Do you see? So everything's culture, isn't it?
Right.
It's not Buddhist, darling. I would suggest it's not Buddhist.
Thank you so much for explaining that.
It's a pleasure, sweetheart. What else? That's enough. I've got no voice left. Thank you. So we delight all our time together.
Yeah.
And we all the seeds we planted, all the virtue we've created, maybe never give up. May we stay optimistic. May we never stop practicing, developing our marvelous potential so we can be a benefit to others, no matter how long it takes. Okay. I can't say more than that. That'll do. And may all our gurus live long, 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 long lives. His Holiness, Geshe Lhasa Lama Zopa Rinpoche, all our lamas, all the holy beings, may they live a long, long life. We need them badly on this earth. Okay. May compassion grow and grow in the hearts of all. That'll do. Oh, you've got to do mandala. Okay, go on.
Yes. And I'll quickly read our dedications from today's sponsors. Thank you, from Lloyd Foreman, thank you to the wise teachers, staff, and volunteers who are responsible for Kadampa Center being a shining jewel in North Carolina. And from Laura Carballo, thank you for the wonderful Dharma teachings that are available to us. And thank you, Venerable Rubina.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
In the gold...